You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The direct predecessor to AIPAC was something called the American Zionist Emergency Council, AZEC. This was founded in about 1939 to propagandize every sector of U.S. society. They not only had lots of money, they used it well. So AZEC specifically targeted congressmen, Christian clergy, editors, professors, both business and labor, Jewish war veterans. They especially targeted the Jewish population with Zionist propaganda. They created hundreds of local committees around the United States. They funded books, made major bestsellers. Other books they didn't like, they called the author anti-Semitic and would bury them. They worked to manufacture Christian support, since the majority of the population was Christian. So they have some Christian groups that would also push the Zionist movement of creating a Jewish state in Palestine.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Allison Weir. Today's show, Political Zionism, the U.S. Connection. Allison Weir is a journalist, author, and public speaker. She is the author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. She is founder and executive director of If Americans Knew, a nonprofit dedicated to accurately informing Americans. She is president of the Council for the National Interest and has authored a pamphlet, The International Campaign to Criminalize Criticism of Israel. As a result, advocacy for Palestinian rights is on the way to being curtailed and even criminalized as hate. On February 17, 2017, Allison Weir spoke at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists. Allison Weir.
Thank you very much. Tonight I'll be talking about Palestine, Israel, and the United States. We hear a lot about Israel from the mainstream media all the time, but we don't very often hear about the U.S. connection. So that's what I'll be emphasizing, and that's the subject matter of my book, The U.S. Connection to All of This. Many people ask me how I became involved, since I don't happen to be Jewish or Palestinian or Muslim or Arab. Some people assume, therefore, I must be anti-Semitic, since I'm talking about Palestine, and yet I'm not of any ethnicity that is allowed to talk about it. So I like to tell people how I got involved and how negligent I was for most of my life. I was involved in other issues, like most of you, in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement during Vietnam, etc. But I didn't know about Israel-Palestine. But then finally, in fall of 2000, the Second Intifada, as it's called — Intifada just means uprising, shaking off of oppression — when the Second Intifada started in fall of 2000, I finally decided to pay attention and to just try to follow the news coverage and understand what it was about. And as a journalist — I was a very small town journalist — as a journalist, I quickly noticed that I was hearing one side of a conflict that has two sides. I would hear from and about Israelis in great detail, as we should. I wanted that information. But I expected also to hear about Palestinians. But I noticed that came much less often and with much less detail. And so at that time, as you may remember, Google was just starting. We could do searches and discover things. And I did that. I started to go on the Internet to see what I could learn. And I found that there were excellent news sources from the region itself: Palestinian media, Israeli media, human rights organizations there on the ground that were sending out daily reports of what was going on. And I started to read those every day, every night after work, and I was horrified at what I was reading and the cover-up that I was noticing here. I remember one news report that I read was from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. It was reporting about the findings of an Israeli academic. And in that Israeli newspaper, it said that although by that time I knew that Israel was shooting large numbers of unarmed demonstrators in cold blood, including children, but then I read in this article that their strategy, very calculated in what they do, the government, the strategy was to not kill too many of those Palestinians, because if they killed too many, they were concerned that maybe the world would notice and maybe something would happen. So apparently they were keeping the killing to low enough amounts that it was okay, but they were injuring multitudes intentionally. In fact, according to this Israeli report, they were specifically targeting knees and eyes because injuries would be off the radar. With that kind of information and my new awareness that it was my tax money that was doing it and my negligence for most of my life that was enabling it, I decided I would go over and see for myself what was going on. And so began the most unusual trip I've ever undertaken. Many years before, I had been in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan. In that case, I had a very official support system helping me. In this case, I was going to be traveling alone. I had no organization helping or guiding me. This was before ISM, et cetera. And so when I landed on February 7th, 2001 at 8 p.m., I remember experiencing the pang of disquiet I'd been trying to ignore on that very long airplane flight. What was it going to be like for me as a single female American to wander alone through a largely Muslim land that was in the middle of a violent uprising? And that was the epicenter of a region that we're continually told to this day is hostile to Americans and to women. What was it going to be like for me to wander around alone? Well, what I found, as I'm sure many of you have been there, I found that people were welcoming, kind, normal people who love for children. I traveled randomly throughout Gaza and the West Bank, occasionally getting lost. And I found out that it was a population full of joy and happiness and grief and welcoming. But I also found out what was being done to them. I remember traveling throughout both the West Bank and Gaza, and I'd be going along, and suddenly there would be an Israeli checkpoint stop you in the middle of supposedly Palestinian territory. And by checkpoint, as I expect you know, I don't mean a toll booth. I mean soldiers in combat gear with machine guns. I remember almost getting used to that. I remember arriving at a corner in Gaza in particular and seeing soldiers in a tank with a fixed machine gun aimed straight at you. You hoped they waved you on rather than shooting you, as they did some people. At night, you couldn't see the soldiers very well in the dark, but you could see the flashlight with which they signaled whether or not you could continue driving, whether or not you could continue living. That was just routine. That was in the good parts of Gaza. The less desirable parts looked like this. These are the pictures that I took. Please remember, this was early 2001. This was before a single rocket had been fired from Gaza. This is what it looked like. This is years before Hamas was elected. This is what was being done. As I was going around this area, crowds of people would gather around me. They were smiling at me and welcoming me to their Swiss cheese homes. Children would come and show me spent bullets that were everywhere. And at one point, as I was going around this is the Tufa area of Khan Yunis in Gaza. I remember there was suddenly Israeli gunfire very near. We all sort of ducked and moved away from that area. And then I remember there were beautiful agricultural lands being destroyed next to the beautiful blue Mediterranean Sea. They're being wiped out. I remember talking to farmers who had farmed there forever. Their fathers had farmed that land, their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers. Generation upon generation had farmed that land. And now their crops were destroyed, their orchards were destroyed. I wondered how they would feed their children. I wondered, how does a farmer feed his children when everything is gone? And that's what it was like before it got bad. I don't like seeing suffering. I don't like seeing children in pain. But thousands of children, I was aware, had already been injured by that time through the use of my money. So as a journalist, it was my job to see them. And all I had to do was go to the nearest hospital. That's all you have to do. And I saw children with bullets in their backs, often their backs, they're running away, but also in their stomach, in their teeth, in their legs, in their chests. I saw a little brain dead boy who had been shot in the head. I remember I saw one boy whose parents were happy to see me because they thought that as an American, maybe I could help their poor son. So I asked the doctor if maybe I could do something. Perhaps a surgical team could come or their son could be flown to the United States. And the doctor told me in front of the parents who didn't speak English, he said that he hadn't found the right time and the right way to tell the parents yet, but that their son was totally and eternally paralyzed. And so I knew something those parents didn't know, and I wished that I didn't. And now you do too. I went to the West Bank, and I remember there was a little boy had just been shot. I went to his home, and I saw the flowers in the living room, the wall hanging over the front door that said, God bless our home, the family photos on the wall. I remember when the family, the parents, got home from the hospital, and the mother was weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. There are so many deaths. There were funerals pretty much every day. I remember in one funeral, I was there with the crowd interviewing people, and I ended up talking to this woman whose friend had just been killed. And she told me about her friend who had three sons, 18, 14, and 12. And she said that just a few days before, her friend had asked her what it was like to go to college in the United States. This woman had gone to college in America, because her 18-year-old son wanted to go to college in America. But this woman explained to me, of course he won't go now. He'll stay home to help with his brothers. And then on future trips, I've been back a number of times, I saw the wall imprisoning the people still more, confiscating still more land. I saw the Kafkaesque way that you get out of Bethlehem, if you're even allowed out of the prison that Bethlehem has become. And when I went back to Gaza last, about 5 years ago, this is what parts of it looked like. These had been full of people when I was there before. And so when I came back to the United States in 2001, I started an organization called If Americans Knew. And I didn't accept some Americans. I didn't say if liberals knew, if leftists knew, if Jews knew, if Muslims knew, if Christians knew. I just said if Americans knew. We also especially focus on media coverage because I feel strongly that the most powerful institution in a country that is a democracy or a republic, the most powerful institution are the news media. That's how we learn what we think we know, whether it's Fox News or KPFA. It's the news media. So we decided to do studies of news coverage on this issue to try to quantify what was going on. My son is a scientist. I like the idea of a sort of scientific study that will be as immune to subjective bias as possible and that would be on a subject considered universally acknowledged as significant. So we looked at coverage of deaths among both populations. The key word is both. To me, all human beings matter. All deaths are tragic, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, nationality. All of the deaths we're talking about are tragic. We also looked at a subcategory that's especially important, I feel the killing of children. We all feel that children are illegitimate targets of strife. They're not supposed to be killed, but they are being killed. And we also looked at the first year of the uprising. All of this is on our website in detail. Because as we all know, first impressions are so powerful. They determine for people who they think started the violence, who is retaliating, who is defending themselves.
You're listening to journalist, author, and activist Allison Weir. Today's show, Political Zionism, the U.S. Connection. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So we needed, first of all, to find out, well, how many children on both sides were killed to answer this very sad question. Using an Israeli source, we discovered 28 Israeli children had tragically been killed, and 131 Palestinian children had tragically been killed that first 12 months. How many of these deaths were covered by our primetime network news shows? Well, we found out that they were reporting Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on Palestinian children's deaths. We found that many media report so minimally on Palestinian children's deaths that many people don't even know they're being killed, even though they were killed in far greater numbers and first. National Public Radio, that many people feel is a more reliable source of information, that's been attacked by Israel partisans as supposedly pro-Palestinian in its coverage. So a group called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, decided to do a study of NPR's coverage, because that's a very serious accusation if NPR was being biased in their coverage. Their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent job, and he discovered that NPR is indeed very distorted in their coverage on this issue. But once again, it's actually in a pro-Israel direction. He found that NPR had covered almost 90% of Israeli children's deaths and only 20% of Palestinian children's deaths. He gave his study what I consider a brilliant title. He called it the illusion of balance, because Ackerman found that NPR had carried almost the exact same number of news reports of Israeli children killed and Palestinian children killed, making it look like that was just balanced, unbiased reporting. In reality, that wasn't balanced. That was distortion. I would suggest that was manipulation. Often in the last 16 years, when there's Palestinian violence and when an Israeli is killed, we hear that Palestinians have shattered a period of calm. Again and again, the American public is told that Palestinians shattered a period of calm. There was a headline of that sort in the LA Times in 2005. I happened to be living in Los Angeles at that time. I saw their headline on the website before the newspaper would be printed for the next day. So I called up the Los Angeles Times because I thought that they would not want to print an inaccurate headline. And I told them that during a period that they were saying was calm, 170 Palestinian men, women, and children had been killed. And that during a period they said was calm, 379 had been injured. Their response to me was, "We said relative calm," and they hung up the phone. There's so many omissions, I can just give a few of them tonight. There is dissent in Israel. We almost never learn about that. There are rabbis for human rights, there are women's groups, Israelis against home demolitions, Israelis against torture. There are soldiers refusing to serve in the occupation. We just almost never hear about that phenomenon. Also, many people will say to me, I think maybe in Berkeley people know more, but many people will say, if only Palestinians would use nonviolence. Well, as I'm sure you know, they do every week, every single week. There's at least one nonviolent demonstration, usually two or three. Often in small villages, farmers, I've been there, I'm sure others of you have been there. We've seen farmers, we've been with them. They have nonviolent demonstrations. In quite a few cases, people from around the world of all backgrounds and ethnicities come and join in that, including Israelis. But we almost never hear about it. Most of the American public doesn't know it exists. And this is extremely courageous for people to do this because they are inevitably met by fierce violence from Israeli forces. Many people have been killed and injured doing this. Most of them are Palestinian. But some have been from other countries. Some have been Americans. Rachel Corrie was 23 years old. Tom Herndahl was 21 years old. Some others have been injured. Emily Hanashewitz lost an eye. Tristan Anderson's from Oakland. Now he's brain damaged and in a wheelchair. The media leave this out. Another omission of a very, very different sort occurred in 2003. This one wasn't far away on the other side of the world. This was in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill. Somehow the media missed this. There was a briefing on Capitol Hill on the findings of the Independent Commission on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. Chairing that commission was Admiral Thomas Moore, a four-star admiral. That's pretty high ranking. Also, he had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Also part of the commission was Rear Admiral Merlin Starring. And not just any Rear Admiral. He had been in charge of the whole legal department of the U.S. Navy. Also part of the commission was a Marine General. And not just any Marine General. This was Ray Davis. This man was the highest ranking Congressional Medal of Honor recipient in the United States. They announced their findings in the Rayburn House office building on Capitol Hill, that Israel had attacked and tried to sink a U.S. Navy ship, that Israeli forces had killed 34 Americans and injured over 170, that this had, according to the findings of Admiral Moore, that this constituted an act of war by Israel against the United States. They also announced that rescue flights to these men had been recalled by order of the President of the United States. They also announced that this incident had been ordered covered up by the President of the United States. Statements of that gravity made on Capitol Hill by military officials of that high rank are newsworthy. And yet there was nothing about them in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the allegedly patriotic network Fox News missed it. About the only place you could read about that is in the Congressional Record. It's all there in detail. And the Stars and Stripes newspaper, the military newspaper overseas, covered it. Now, when I began to look into this, I wondered, well, when and how did this start? And how did the U.S. come to have such a special relationship with Israel? Of course, many of you may be my age or possibly even older. One of the first things I learned was that when I was born, there was no Israel. It did not exist. There was Palestine. It was a region when I was born under the British Empire, before that under the Ottoman Empire. So when and how did the violence begin? Not thousands of years ago, the way people are often led to believe. The way you know that is we're talking history here. These things are easily discovered. In the late 1800s, the region was called Palestine, and it was without violence as it had been for centuries. The population was largely what today we would call multicultural, in that it was about 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, a little under 5% Jewish, all living together for centuries. So what happened? What changed that? Well, it was an ideological movement that changed it, and it did not originate in that region. It originated in Europe and in the United States to a much greater degree than I had known. This was a movement called political Zionism. The intention and goal was to create a Jewish state in Palestine, even though that meant dispossessing 95% of the inhabitants. What struck me when I was writing my book, and still strikes me, is that Zionism is an extremely significant ideology. And yet most Americans have not heard about it and could not define it. I went to a 50-year high school anniversary, and I tried it out on some, you know, very intelligent classmates. Do you know what Zionism is? And they would sort of say, let me think now, I've heard of that. What is that? That's what I would have answered. And yet we've all know socialism, communism, fascism, capitalism, etc. And yet Zionism has tragically impacted the Middle East, dangerously impacted the whole world, and it has been extremely damaging to the United States as well. And most of us don't even know about it. Well, I discovered that Zionism, political Zionism, began worldwide, but in the United States, especially, I'm focusing on, in the late 1800s. In the late 1800s. By 1910, it was already becoming a significant movement. It was already becoming the kind of movement that politicians pay attention to, especially in the larger eastern cities. It was a small minority of Jewish Americans, most of whom were not Zionists, some of whom were actively anti-Zionist. But it was a significant number of people, 20,000. I think by 1920 it was 200,000. Then in 1914, there was a very significant development. A prominent man, a prominent attorney from Boston, Louis Brandeis, became the head of World Zionism. World Zionism moved to the United States under Brandeis for a period. In 1916, Brandeis became a Supreme Court justice. And as I expect you feel the way I do, most of us cannot name many Supreme Court justices from the past century. You know, maybe a dozen, if that, maybe two. But most of us do know about Brandeis. He's very respected. He was very significant. And yet I hadn't realized that he was in charge of World Zionism. But then I discovered even more about him that was very sad for me to learn. I found that what happened is when he became a Supreme Court justice, the normal practice is you resign your memberships and your affiliations because you're supposed to be neutral and not have even the perception of conflict of interest. So he resigned his leadership of World Zionism, but he continued secretly to lead it from his Supreme Court chambers. This was written about a number of places. His loyal lieutenants, one of whom was Felix Frankfurter, who also became a Supreme Court justice, would come into the chambers of Brandeis and report on how they were doing with pushing Zionism in the United States, and Brandeis would give them directions to go and carry out. That was shocking.
You're listening to journalist, author, and activist Allison Weir. Today's show, Political Zionism, the U.S. Connection. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
But then I discovered something even more shocking, and I'm just the messenger of this bad news. I did not create it. I get attacked for it. But I didn't create it. I just discovered it. I read a book called Israel in the Mind of America by a well-regarded journalist, author named Peter Gross. He was at the New York Times for many years. He was at Harvard. He wrote a number of other nonfiction books. He is, if anything, he tilts towards Israel. He's certainly much more sympathetic to Israel than to the Palestinians. And in his book, he wrote that there was a secret Zionist society operating in the United States that Brandeis had been a leader of, called the Parashim. And I thought, where in the world did that come from? So, of course, I read the footnote. In fact, that's how I got all my information. I read book after book. I'd read the footnotes, get more books. And so I read the footnote, and it turned out to be from a scholarly journal, the American Jewish Historical Quarterly, 1975. Has an article we have now posted online so everyone can read it, called The Parashim, a Secret Episode in American Zionist History. But who was the author? Was this one of these anti-Semites that we always hear about? This was Dr. Sarah Schmidt, an Israeli professor at a mainstream Israeli university. She wrote about it in that article. She has a whole chapter about it in her book about Horace Kallen. She wrote about it a few other places as well. Peter Gross also wrote about it a few other places as well, including Moment Magazine. It's a Jewish publication. It turned out this did indeed exist. It was an elitist society. They were pushing Zionism across the United States. As one of them said, the way to do it was education and infection. That's a quote. There was even an initiation ceremony when somebody would join this society in which the individual would be inducted and swear that they would consider their devotion to Zionism greater than that of family, of school, of nation. And two Supreme Court justices were in that. As early as 1915, a leader of the Parashim, Horace Kallen, a professor from the University of Wisconsin, suggested to the British that they might benefit from a declaration in support of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine in 1915. Those of you who have heard of the Balfour Declaration that came in 1917 may be connecting that suggestion. But others, who might be the way I would have been, would wonder, well, what would the British have to do with this? Huge as the British Empire was, in 1915, Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. The British had nothing whatsoever to do with it, one would think. So why was Horace Kallen suggesting this? Well, let's remember what was going on at this time. It was what they called the Great War. Massive carnage and death. And during this war was not just against Germany. That's what most of us remember. It was also against the Ottoman Empire. So if the British won this war, they would defeat the Ottoman Empire, and then they would be in charge of Palestine, potentially. So at some parts of this war, early on in particular, Britain wasn't winning it. You know, in retrospect, we know how it came out. At the time, you don't know. And in fact, at the first day of the Battle of the Somme, British forces had 50,000, I think it was 60,000 casualties in one day of battle. They were desperate. So some Zionist leaders went to the British government, Chaim Weizmann in particular, and they claimed that they said that if the British government would facilitate their colonist movement on Palestine, if they would do that, if they would promise to do that, the Zionists claimed that they would bring the U.S. into the war on the side of Britain. They specifically talked about Louis Brandeis, who was close to Woodrow Wilson, as being one of the venues by which they could accomplish that. This is written in a number of books by pro-Israel authors. It was called A Gentleman's Agreement. This is how the Balfour Declaration was obtained, with that promise. It basically was just saying, it's very mild terminology, but it opened the door to colonization of Palestine. Then in the Paris Peace Conference, after the war, when the British and the French basically divided up the spoils, the Zionists pushed for the Balfour wording, which would allow Jewish colonization of Palestine to go on. When that began, as more and more Zionists and misled Jewish individuals who didn't know that they were going to an inhabited land, you may recall that the slogan was a land without a people for a people without a land. So many people believed that slogan. So with the increased colonization, sadly, there was violent conflict. It's predictable, it's sad, but it's predictable. People don't want to be pushed off their land. When they notice what's going on, they will eventually fight back. So there was violence, there were some Zionist terrorist groups were created. And again, I'm trying to mostly focus on the U.S. It turns out that these groups had front groups in the United States, the Irgun and the Stern Gang, paramilitary organizations, terrorist organizations, had groups in the United States that were raising money for them and funneling weaponry to them. But the precursor to today's AIPAC, right now, one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C., according to Fortune magazine, it's in the top two, is something called the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. Well, the direct predecessor to AIPAC was something called the American Zionist Emergency Council, AZEC. This was founded in about 1939, and by 1943, it had a budget of $500,000 at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. By 1939, it had access to a larger fund that was $14 million, and by 1948, $150 million. I believe in today's dollars, I believe that's about $1 billion that they had access to use to propagandize every sector of U.S. society. They not only had lots of money, they used it well. Again, they had written documents about what they were doing. This is written down. They had annual reports about what they were doing. So AZEC specifically targeted congressmen, Christian clergy, editors, professors, both business and labor, Jewish war veterans. They especially targeted the Jewish population with Zionist propaganda. They created hundreds of local committees around the United States. They funded books, made major bestsellers. Other books they didn't like, they called the author anti-Semitic and would bury them. They worked to manufacture Christian support, since the majority of the population was Christian. So they specifically used secret funding to have some Christian groups that would also push the Zionist movement of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. During all of this time, there was surprising opposition to Zionism from diverse sources. I'll go through these one by one. Some of the most distinguished American pastors at the time opposed Zionism for moral and religious reasons. Some went to the Paris Peace Talks to specifically argue on behalf of self-determination for the Arab peoples. One Dead Sea scholar wrote a wonderful book called Palestine is Our Business. Jewish anti-Zionists were also extremely active opposing Zionism. Elmer Berger, Alfred Lilienthal both wrote very powerful books. The next may be surprising to many of you. The State Department, the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies were also opposed to Zionism. This is thoroughly documented in my book. I have quite a few quotes, and there are many more than I put in my very thin book. Starting under President Taft, the Secretary of State opposed Zionism. Under Wilson, he sent a group to look at the situation in Palestine, to explore the feasibility of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. The group came back with an extremely powerful report saying it would be a grave trespass on the rights of the people, that Zionism should be abandoned. But their report was buried and had no impact. There was quote after quote saying that this would be wrong, that it would damage the United States, that it would hurt American strategic interests, that it would place America in danger if we supported Zionism. But Harry Truman, like politicians today, our current one and our past president, both basically say, I'm sorry, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents. That was Harry Truman. And that's what everybody else has basically said since. In 1947, after World War II, there was increasing violence within Palestine because of the colonization. So there was lots of violence between the two groups, the indigenous Palestinians and the Zionists. And also much of the violence was against the British occupation. So finally, Britain turned the question of Palestine over to the United Nations to solve. At that point, the United Nations, this new organization, could have affirmed its charter principle, the bedrock principle of democracy, which is very simple, self-determination of peoples. The people on that land could have finally formed their own country and their own government, free and fair elections. But instead of doing that, even after decades of colonization and immigration to create a Jewish state and to try to buy up all of the land, Zionists had only bought up a total of about 8% of the land. Most people say 5 to 6%. And they were still only 30% of the entire population. So they didn't want free and open elections because they were not the majority. So instead, they pushed through a partition plan using bribes and threats, again, very well documented. And they got a partition plan in which 55% of Palestine would go to a Jewish state, even though that population was 30%, and the Palestinians would get about 45%. As we have seen, the more unfair a situation, the more unjust a situation, the more violence that ensues. So rather than bringing peace, it brought outright war. Israel calls this its war of independence. Palestinians call it the catastrophe, al-Nakba. It was a huge, huge humanitarian catastrophe. At least 750,000 people were very ruthlessly pushed off their land. Children were dying on the roadside. Nobody knows really how many people died during this. Most Americans didn't know about it. Most of the reporting was done from the Zionist perspective then as now. But some tried to. One was a woman named Dorothy Thompson. Dorothy Thompson, according to the Britannica Encyclopedia, is one of the most important journalists of the 20th century. I think they called her the most important or famous female journalist of the 20th century. And yet most of us have never heard of her. She was amazing. She had a radio program listened to by millions of Americans. She was such a celebrity. She was so powerful. She was considered the second most powerful woman after Eleanor Roosevelt. She was such a celebrity that there was a Broadway play based on her life and a Hollywood movie based on her life. She had been a foreign correspondent in Germany in the 1930s. As was one of the first to raise the alarm about Hitler. She was, in fact, the first foreign correspondent to be ejected by Hitler. So she was very sympathetic to Zionism. But then after the war and after Israel was created, she went over to see this wonderful new Jewish state that had been created. And she saw hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees dying daily, living under very harsh conditions. And so she began to write about them. She was a wonderful writer, and to speak about them. And for doing that, she was called anti-Semitic. She lost her job. She lost her fame for telling about these people. And as her biographer put it, she was erased from history.
You're listening to journalist, author, and activist Allison Weir. Today's show, Political Zionism, the U.S. Connection. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And if I tried now to write an article for a popular history magazine from one of the many anecdotes from my book and from my research, which is what an author would usually do, and if I tried to submit it to American History Magazine, that would be the obvious place, it wouldn't get printed. How do I know that? Well, I know that. This is not speculation. This is because several years ago, our organization, Council for the National Interest, tried to submit a paid advertisement to American History Magazine, not for my book, for another book, by a 90-year-old retired American congressman and Republican. And we were told by Eric Weider, the owner of American History Magazine, that because our organization was, quote, anti-Zionist, they would not publish any advertisements from us ever in American History Magazine or, he volunteered, in any of the magazines that he owns, which is just about every popular history magazine in this country. According to their website, this is the largest history magazine chain in the world. Now, tonight in the announcement for my lecture, I added that I would be talking about Trump's Muslim ban. Bring this up a little bit to the present. So let's look at that. I've just written an article, and we have it here as a booklet. I hope you will read it. When you read it online, it has citations, all of its embedded links, so you can see where the information came from. Trump's executive order, which is getting a great deal of attention, as it should, and a great deal of protest, as I agree it should get, has roots that most people are ignoring and the media are not mentioning. A little bit has been mentioned that I'll tell you about, but most of what I'm going to tell you about has not been mentioned anywhere. In this, he targets 7 countries: Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Iran. Anyway, he targeted 7 countries. It's not actually in the executive order. In the executive order, he only talks about Syria. But he refers to a statute where these other countries are countries of concern. Well, how did these countries become countries of concern? That was under Barack Obama and Congress and Dianne Feinstein. Legislation in 2015 and 2016 made those same countries countries of interest. That's where Trump got those countries. In the protests, I don't hear that being talked about. It turns out that these same countries, except for one, had been targeted in previous plans. In 2001, all of them, except for one, were targeted to be taken down. This was divulged by a speech given by General Wesley Clark, a 4-star general. He gave his speech that's online at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club. He says that in 2001, he was in the Pentagon shortly after 9/11, dropped by some of his friends' offices, you know, he knew a number of the people there, and then he was walking the hall of the Pentagon and a general came up and said, you know, come over here, there's something I want to tell you about. So I went over there and he said, they're going to attack Iraq. And Clark said, Iraq? Is there some evidence? He said, no, there's no evidence. They're just going to do it. So then I believe it was, let me think, it was I think a month later, maybe 6 weeks later, he was in the Pentagon again. He saw the same officer who had told him that. And the officer said that, he said, oh, you know, what's going on? Is the plan still to attack Iraq? And the officer said, oh, it's worse than that. It's worse than that. They're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq, then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran. This was in 2001. Then Clark, in his speech, I wasn't there in person, I saw it online. Then he said, then I remembered a conversation I had in 1991 with Paul Wolfowitz. Many of you may know very, very fervently pro-Israel neoconservative Paul Wolfowitz, who had in 1991 had talked about this is our chance to clean up Syria, Iran, and Iraq in 1991. Wesley's speech is very strong. Again, if you go to my article online, the links are there to watch it for yourself. He emphasizes this was a coup. There was a coup in the United States, he says. There was a policy coup in the United States by Wolfowitz, by the other neocons, by the Project for a New American Century, he specifically mentions. He said, did you know about this to the audience? Did you hear about it? Was it discussed? Was it debated? No, it was just put through. There was a 1996 plan on behalf of Israel called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm. This was a position paper, a strategy paper for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, written by American officials. The realm they were talking about protecting was Israel, not the United States. And in it, they specifically talk about the need to shape Israel's environment, to take down, to damage, to fragment the countries around Israel. As Clark said, they wanted to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. That was the plan, and they did. We invaded Iraq largely on behalf of Israel. This is written about openly in the Israeli press. This is in my article. I won't go through it all now. Now, is that where it started in 91? No. You go back to 1982. There's something called usually we call it the Yenon Plan, Oded Yenon. The full title was A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. This was published by the World Zionist Organization. It's online also, very long document. It called for the dissolution and downfall of existing Arab states. It specifically mentions Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Libya, Lebanon. Here's some quotes from it. The entire Arabian Peninsula is a natural candidate for dissolution, breaking Egypt down. If Egypt falls apart, countries like Libya, Sudan, or even the more distant states will not continue to exist in their present form and will join the downfall and dissolution of Egypt. These are direct quotes. They talk about Iraq. Quote, Iraq, rich in oil, is guaranteed as a candidate for Israel's targets. Its dissolution is even more important for us than that of Syria. Iraq is stronger than Syria. In the short run, it is Iraqi power which constitutes the greatest threat to Israel. An Iraqi-Iranian war will tear Iraq apart. There was a war. And cause its downfall at home even before it is able to organize a struggle on a wide front against us. Every kind of inter-Arab confrontation will assist us in the short run and will shorten the way to the more important aim of breaking up Iraq into denominations as in Syria and in Lebanon. This is a direct quote from 1982. Did it start in 1982? No. Let's look at 1954. This is again online. This is a book that I read a number of years ago. I just never got around to talking about any of this in my other talks. By Moshe Charet, his diary was written about by his daughter, and it's quoted, that already from Israel's earliest days, there were plans to dismember the Arab world, defeat the Arab national movement, and create puppet regimes. Ben-Gurion talked about a plan for putting a Christian in charge of Lebanon and breaking Lebanon up. There's much more about it. You can read the document as well as I can. And they've done that to these regimes. We've done it. The destruction of Iraq was a major factor in the rise of ISIS. Many people have acknowledged that obvious reality. WikiLeaks divulged one of Hillary's emails in which she said the best way to help Israel is to help the people of Syria overthrow the regime of Bashar Assad. I can't remember how many million of people have fled, either externally or internally. 300,000 at least are dead. 300,000. And then, as the UK Guardian very honestly said, the disorder and chaos that we see now in Syria, with the multitudes of people fleeing, going into Europe, some trying and hoping to come here, UK Guardian wrote, disorder and chaos sweeping through the region would not be an unfortunate side effect of war with Iraq, but a sign that everything is going according to plan. That was the plan. All of this is going on and on and on, and going on and on and on with our tax money. I just finished with a letter I wrote while I was in Gaza on my first trip. I wrote to Americans back home, and I'll just read it now. I wrote, come to Palestine and see how your tax dollars are spent. Visit a hospital with me and see a boy with a bullet hole in his back. See children with scared eyes and legs that don't work anymore. A terrified old man whose neck is swathed in bandages from the bullet that passed through it as he sat in his home drinking his tea. Come with me and visit mothers of dead, injured, gone children, thousands of them. And tell them how you didn't know we supplied the weapons that ripped flesh, broke bones, destroyed lives. talk to old women who are made to kowtow to Uzi toting 19-year-olds who tell them, no, you can't go to visit your son today. No, you can't take a drive in the country. No, you can't go to the hospital and have your chemotherapy, your dialysis, your operation, and watch as they die. Come to the borders with me, invisible lines in the sand between towns that Israel has drawn with its tanks and helicopters and 200 nuclear weapons, and watch the women with difficult births deliver dead babies and then die themselves at military checkpoints, death points, when soldiers with their ultimate power decide not to let them pass. Listen to these young warriors with their lethal weapons and deadly tempers proclaim, we've decided to close this road, and if you don't like it, we'll shoot you, as we already have 10,000 of your countrymen. Don't look at us wrong, or we'll shoot out your eyes, as we have 28 of your children. We're not cruel. We left 27 of them with one eye. Go home, Arab, and wait, and pray we don't decide to shell it, as we have thousands of those others who were in our way with the wonderful singing missiles the U.S. gives us. Go harvest your crops, Arab, until we decide to bulldoze your 100-year-old date palms and ancient olive groves, your strawberry fields forever gone. Come to Palestine, Americans, and see your tax dollars at work, millions and millions of them every day, every day. And weep with me for our victims and our guilt. And then say, no more.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You've been listening to Alison Weir. Today's show has been Political Zionism, the U.S. Connection. Alison Weir is a journalist, author, and public speaker. She is the author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. She founded and is executive director of If Americans Knew, a nonprofit dedicated to accurately informing Americans. She is president of the Council for the National Interest and has authored a pamphlet, The International Campaign to Criminalize Criticism of Israel. Visit her website at ifamericansknew.org. That's ifamericansknew.org. Also visit the If Americans Knew blog at israelpalestinenews.org. That's israelpalestinenews.org. Today's audio recording, courtesy of Hamouk at 911tv.org. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Listener advisory. The following show has adult language and adult themes concerning human sexuality. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, a frank critique of that icon of the 50s, the late Hugh M. Hefner. There's some criticism, for sure, but some appreciation, too. I hope you'll stay tuned. Hugh Hefner, creator of Playboy magazine, died last month, September 2017. I can't imagine who would replace him. I can't imagine what a 21st century replacement would even look like. And I'm not sure that he ought to be replaced. Still, Hefner was an important person in American cultural history, and I think we should remember that he did some very real good in the world. So, much of our show this week will be about Hef. A measure of his cultural importance is the long article the New York Times published at his death. The online version runs no less than 2,600 words, plus several photographs. I'm going to read my much-condensed version of that Times piece. Then, following a song by Tom Lehrer, I'd like to talk about my own thoughts and experiences with Hefner and his Playboy magazine. With Hefner, there's a lot to criticize, but there's a good deal to praise, too. Let's start with the excellent New York Times story. It's titled, Hugh Hefner, Who Built the Playboy Empire and Embodied It, Dies at 91, by Laura Manzneris. Condensed and edited for radio by yours truly. Here we go. Hugh Hefner, who created Playboy magazine and spun it into a media and entertainment industry giant, died September 27 at his home, the Playboy Mansion, in Los Angeles. He was 91. The man and Playboy the brand were inseparable. Both advertised themselves as emblems of the sexual revolution, an escape from American priggishness and wider social intolerance. Both were derided over the years, as vulgar, as adolescent, as exploitative, and finally as anachronistic. But Mr. Hefner was a stunning success from the moment he emerged in the 1950s. The first issue of Playboy was published in 1953, when Hefner was 27, a new father, married, he said, to the first woman he had slept with. He had only recently moved out of his parents' house, but in an editorial in Playboy's inaugural issue, the young publisher purveyed another life. Quote, "We enjoy mixing up cocktails and an hors d'oeuvre or two, putting a little mood music on the phonograph, and inviting a female acquaintance for a quiet discussion on Picasso, Nietzsche, jazz, sex." Unquote. Todd Gitlin, a sociologist at Columbia University, said, "It's part of an ensemble with the James Bond movies, John F. Kennedy, swinging, the guy who is young, vigorous, indifferent to the bonds of social responsibility." Unquote. Continuing with Laura Manzneris's article, Hugh Marston Hefner was born on April 9, 1926, the son of Nebraska Methodists who had moved to Chicago. Hefner told interviewers that he had grown up with a lot of repression, quote-unquote. The first issue of Playboy was financed with $600 of his own money and several thousand more in borrowed funds, including $1,000 borrowed from his mother. His biggest asset was rights to a nude calendar photograph of Marilyn Monroe. This first issue was published in December 1953. The magazine was a hit, and circulation soared. Many other men's magazines showed nude women, but most were crude and forever dodging postal censors. With Playboy, Hefner aimed to be the first with a mainstream readership. In the 1950s, when Hefner began denouncing American Puritanism, doctors were refusing contraceptives to single women, and Hollywood insisted on separate beds for married couples. The Playboy philosophy, quote unquote, was a long-running series of essays in the magazine. Hefner wrote it in 25 installments, starting in 1962. These essays were a mix of libertarian and libertine arguments. The Playboy philosophy crusaded for abortion rights, decriminalization of marijuana, freedom of speech, and the repeal of 19th-century anti-sex laws. These were daring positions at the time. For this, Mr. Hefner won several civil liberties awards. He supported progressive social causes, including civil rights, at a time when much of the nation still had Jim Crow laws. In the 1950s, Mr. Hefner was reviled by guardians of the social order, including J. Edgar Hoover. Later, he was reviled by feminists. Playboy's circulation reached 1 million by 1960 and peaked at about 7 million in the 1970s. Hefner won, sociologist Todd Gitlin said. Continuing the quote, "The prevailing values in the country now are essentially libertarian, and that basically was what the Playboy philosophy was. It's laissez-faire, it's anti-censorship, it's consumerist, it's hedonistic. In the longer run, Hugh Hefner's significance is as a salesman of the libertarian ideal," unquote, quoting sociologist Todd Gitlin. Playboy magazine was a forum for serious interviews. The subjects included Jimmy Carter, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Malcolm X. Playboy published fiction by Ray Bradbury, including Fahrenheit 451, also by Herbert Gold, Bud Schulberg, Vladimir Nabokov, Kurt Vonnegut, Saul Bellow, Bernard Malamud, James Baldwin, John Updike, and Joyce Carol Oates. Sidebar comment, you'll recognize these as very important names in American literature in the 20th century. Back to the text. Eventually, other publications made the nude Playmate centerfold look less than daring. Still, Playboy remained the most successful men's magazine in the world. Mr. Hefner's company branched into movie, cable, and digital production, sold its own line of clothing and jewelry, and opened clubs, resorts, and casinos. In 1974, Hefner moved himself and his business empire from Chicago to Los Angeles. The brand faded over the years. The 1980s brought a huge retrenchment. The company sold its resorts and its record division, sold We magazine, sold the Playboy building in Chicago, and sold the corporate jet with its built-in discotheque. Bunnies were going the way of go-go dancers, and the Playboy clubs closed. The magazine's circulation declined to less than a million. In 2015, Playboy magazine made the startling decision to stop publishing nude photographs. But 2 years later, in 2017, the nudes returned. And thus ends my much condensed version of the New York Times excellent obituary, published on the day of Hefner's death, September 27, 2017. Playboy was founded in an age when the law courts were beginning to strike down the country's many repressive laws regulating sexuality, contraception, erotic literature, and so forth. Hugh Hefner both campaigned for and benefited from these legal advances in civil liberties. Not everyone was as pleased as Hefner with the direction things were going. Among the dissenters was the satirist Tom Lehrer. Here he is in 1965.
I do have a cause, though. It is obscenity. I'm for it. Thank you. Unfortunately, the civil liberties types who are fighting this issue have to fight it, owing to the nature of the laws, as a matter of freedom of speech and stifling of free expression and so on. But we know what's really involved. Dirty books are fun. That's all there is to it. But you can't get up in the court and say that, I suppose. It's simply a matter of freedom of pleasure, a right which is not guaranteed by the Constitution, unfortunately. Anyway, since people seem to be marching for their causes these days, I have here a march for mine. It's called Smut. Give me smut and nothing but a dirty novel I can't shut if it's uncut and unsut. Tull. I've never quibbled if it was ribald. I would devour where others merely nibbled. As the judge remarked the day that he acquitted my Aunt Hortense, to be smut it must be utterly without redeeming social importance. Pornographic pictures I adore, indecent magazines galore. I like them more if they're hardcore. Bring on the obscene movies, murals, postcards, neckties, samplers, stained glass windows, tattoos, anything. More, I'm still not satisfied. Stories of tortures used by debauchers, lurid, licentious, and vile, make me smile. Novels that pander to my taste for candor give me a pleasure sublime. Let's face it, I love slime. All books can be indecent books, though recent books are bolder. For filth, I'm glad to say, is in the mind of the beholder. When correctly viewed, everything is lewd. I could tell you things about Peter Pan and the Wizard of Oz. There's a dirty old man. Like Fanny Hill, and I suppose I always will, if it is swill and really fill the... Who needs a hobby like tennis or philately? I've got a hobby, rereading Lady Chatterley. But now they're trying to take it all away from us unless we take a stand, and hand in hand we fight for freedom of the press. In other words, smut, I love it. Ah, the adventures of a slut. Oh, I'm a market they can't glut. I don't know what compares with smut. Hip, hip, hooray, let's hear it for the Supreme Court. Don't let them take it away.
Tom Lehrer, who can't seem to decide if he's for or against the new freedom of expression. Which brings us back to Hugh Hefner and Playboy. I'd like to talk about my own personal experiences with the magazine and my own very mixed attitudes towards it. A warning to listeners, this segment contains a great deal of adult language and adult themes concerning sex. Listener discretion is advised. In 2015, Donald Fagen of Steely Dan published a fine essay on the great radio storyteller Gene Shepherd. Fagen showed how Shepherd, like the old Mad magazine, contributed much to Fagen's adolescent development and maturation. But, like Mad magazine, Shepherd proved unable to contribute much to Fagen's development after adolescence. I think that's a brilliant take on Gene Shepherd and Mad magazine both. I feel the same about Mad, and I feel the same about that other crucial publication of the 1950s and 60s, Hugh Hefner's Playboy magazine. At age 16, 17, I bought Playboy each month at the corner store, devoured them, and hid them from my parents. I studied the pictures, but I also read the articles and columns with great interest. I especially looked forward to the Playboy philosophy, which was nearing the end of its run by 1967. I thought it a fine defense of civil liberties and a fine attack on civic hypocrisy and repressive laws. And I still think so. I gained even more from a regular column called The Playboy Advisor. The column was anonymous. Later, I read that the writer was named D. Keith Mono. From Mono's clear, correct answers to readers' questions, I learned much more about sex than I ever learned from sex education class in high school. From the Playboy Advisor, I learned much about female anatomy and the physiology of female sexual response. Specifically, what would be good to do and what not to do to contribute to a woman's sexual pleasure. Yes, female sexual pleasure was an important concern to the so-called Playboy lifestyle. So was the ability to mix a good martini, but never mind that. High school sex education class never mentioned multiple female orgasms, for example, let alone the best ways to help bring them about. Come to think of it, sex ed class never mentioned female orgasm at all. The goal of sex education class was to prolong everybody's virginity through fear. My first sexual intercourse was with a young woman a year older than me and more experienced. I can report that everything went extremely well for both of us. We both found it a wonderful experience. No thanks to Mom and Dad, no thanks to my peers, and especially no thanks to 11th grade sex education class. I owe those wonderful early experiences mostly to D. Keith Mono, the Playboy Advisor, and publisher Hugh Hefner. I have been deeply grateful for 50 years, and I remain so. And yet, Playboy was indeed a force for progressivism and human liberation in the 1950s and 60s. But its vision did not continue to develop along with my own. The magazine's unquestioning celebration of consumer culture and of expensive consumer products never wavered. As I developed, the magazine's gung-ho celebration of the latest expensive consumer products started seeming quaint and at last distasteful. Feminists have long charged that Playboy presents women as just another consumer product, just fashion accessories to purchase along with your sports car and stereo system. I think they're right. And that's not just a social faux pas on Hefner's part. It's also connected to the odd thing about Playboy's nude photos. In the photos, the women seem pretty, but they don't seem sexy. They're like art nudes, except it's not very good art. The photography is too slick. The makeup and hairstyling are too professionally applied. The studio lighting is too impeccably perfect. The pose, the expression on the lady's face are practiced. There is nothing overtly sexual depicted, or even anything suggestive. The effect is not art, and it's not sexy either. It is commercial illustration. It is first-rate industrial photography. So it's not much of a turn-on. Then there's the style of the ladies themselves. In the early years of Playboy magazine, much of the erotic charge was that the naked ladies seem fairly close to being the girl next door. Not exactly the girl next door, maybe the girl next door's beautiful cousin. But the so-called playmate was much more like the girl next door than the hard-painted ladies in the other men's magazines. Any man will tell you that the girl next door taking off her clothes is much more erotic than a Las Vegas stripper taking off her clothes. So Playboy magazine got that right at first. But over the years, the nude playmates seemed to be fewer and fewer real people from Chicago and more aspiring TV actresses from Los Angeles. And they looked it. Okay if you like the style, but not my type. The hippie counterculture offered a different, simpler, and much more natural standard of female beauty. My own tastes drifted that a ways, and have never drifted back. Meanwhile, Playboy's tastes were drifting more towards 22-year-olds at Pomona State College pursuing a career in acting and modeling, according to the Capsule Playmate biographies. And then there are those breasts. Hugh Hefner did the world a great disservice with all those oversized breasts. From Playboy, and also its competitors, one got the impression that the average American young woman would have found a C-cup bra a tight fit. Consequently, in the 1960s, the large majority of American women were convinced that their breasts were much smaller than average. They were also convinced that having breasts that were smaller than average was a big problem that demanded their immediate attention. Ladies with a drawer full of B-cup bras considered themselves flat-chested, and those with A-cups were despondent. Padded bras were ubiquitous. Here's a memory from either high school or possibly my first year in college. A girl's phys ed class is outside doing some kind of calisthenic exercise directed by the teacher. The girls are jumping and moving their shoulders back and forth while chanting a cadence together. The words of the cadence are these: "We must, we must, we must increase the bust." Over and over and over again. After a half century, I've never forgotten that sight. Hugh Hefner is far from the only culprit in fostering that widespread feeling of bust inadequacy, but he was a major culprit. I'm sure there were plenty of beautiful, small-busted women in Chicago and L.A. in the 1960s, not to mention beautiful women of average bust size. Somehow, Playboy magazine never managed to find any. The force that did Playboy magazine in was the flood of free porn on the internet. That flood of free porn, especially the free amateur porn, did some good things. For one, it revealed both the variety and the statistical norms of female body types. Today, you can find naked pictures of 14 million girlfriends, wives, ex-wives, ex-girlfriends, and selves. Naked selfies are all the rage among teenagers and girls in their 20s. These are all over the internet, too, at least for girls over 18. Look at the naked pictures of 1,000 women of normal weight, and then tell me what the average bust size is. Then look at a dozen playmates. Somebody's a standard deviation or two above the mean, and it's not the 1,000 amateur wives and girlfriends. But back to the internet porn. It is hard to judge a person's feelings by her photograph, but in the faces of these lithe young women on the internet, these young women for whom a bra is optional, in their faces I don't see any hint of bad feelings about the shape of their bodies. Certainly not among the women taking naked selfies. Their faces and their body language seem to say, "I'm pretty and I'm sexy and I know it." Their sense of discretion may be lacking, but I do admire the look of self-acceptance. Compares favorably with girls back in my day doing pectoral exercises while chanting, "We must increase the bust." Those may be the first good words you've heard about internet porn, but there you have it. For increasing everyone's appreciation of the beauty of real, ordinary women, including women who wear A-cup bras, the score is Internet Porn 1, Playboy Magazine 0. But Playboy Magazine is dying, and Hugh Hefner is dead. Both are icons of an earlier era, an age that was different from our own. Hugh Hefner helped make our own age what it is, in some bad ways, but also, for sure, in some good ways as well. He was a champion of civil liberties. Civil liberties not only of sex, but also of free speech and freedom of expression, and abortion rights, as the Times obituary mentioned. The part Hefner played in the civil rights struggle was small, but it was real and it was positive. Think of the progressive achievements of our time. Gay rights, gay marriage, transgender rights, the right of all people to buy and use contraceptives, the right to have sex with a partner of your choice without risking arrest. I think Hugh Hefner contributed very substantially to all of these gains. His contribution to women's liberation was much less. But perhaps those civil liberties gains have helped women more than all those silly bunnies and D-cup playmates have hurt them. That's not for me to say. But I will say this. I think he did more good in the world than harm. And I'd be delighted if, years down the road, anybody could say the same about me. Rest in peace. Hugh Marston Hefner died September 27, 2017. To you, too, I say goodbye, though hopefully not forever. Tune in anytime at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Let us end with some Latin almost as bad as illegitimi non carborundum. By the doorbell of the old Playboy Mansion in Chicago was a plaque inscribed in Latin, "Si non osculas, noli tintinare." If you don't swing, don't ring. Ciao.
Listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, which is available at cfmu.ca, our new online service. You can go there right now and see us streaming live on air, Unusual Sources, which of course we are now on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website. So if you go to hcsw.ca, there's a radio section on the right-hand side there, tab menu, and you can get the information about us and links to our podcasting online. And today we have U.S.-based anti-war activist Sarah Flounders on the line with us. Sarah, thanks for coming and joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, we got you direct by phone here, and I'm glad we do, because you have a very timely series of articles out right now. I'm looking at it here. It's called Why U.S. and Saudi Arabia Back Rohingya in Myanmar. And this was posted on workers.org. It might be on the International Action Center website as well, maybe on Global Research. This is actually a multi-part series. I was reading part one. You have part two out now. Is that correct?
That's right. It's the focus is Myanmar's colonial history feeds current strike crisis of Rohingya, India, and the U.S.
And that's an important issue. It certainly is pertinent to what's unfolding there. We got a situation, as you've pointed out, we've got some very destructive forces on the international stage, including the United States and Saudi Arabia, and they seem to have taken a very public interest in the situation of Muslims living in Rakhine. It's caused people who pay attention to these things to ask a lot of questions. I guess we could start with the context of what's going on right now. Certainly the United States has taken interest. You can look all over the corporate media who are suddenly concerned about the situation of Muslims in parts of Myanmar. Now, the United States has plans for an interest in the region, especially with regard to China. I'm wondering, can you tell us, you know, in terms of these interests, how Myanmar fits into that context?
Well, Myanmar is strategically important, bordering China, Bangladesh, India, Thailand, and Laos. And it is, at this point, a major port, oil pipeline, and new sort of transportation hub is being built by China in this very area. So that's what raised, a certain amount of interest on my part, that suddenly the U.S. is coming to the defense of an oppressed grouping in Myanmar, where they have never expressed any interest in the past. And what is China building there is that 80% of China's needed oil and so much of its trade, the overwhelming majority of its trade, passes through the very narrow Malacca Straits. And that's like a narrow choke point, as they say, waterway between Indonesia and Singapore. It's the major route into the South China Sea. And, you know, one aircraft carrier battle group could cut off this entire area, could blockade it easily. Which is something that, of course, U.S. and earlier British policy is well known for, controlling key waterways and choke points and cutting them off. So this is, at least everyone in the world, I think, has heard of and following in some way what's called the pivot to Asia, which is really a U.S. military pivot. Meaning let's turn the attention of a whole military apparatus, missile batteries, aircraft carriers, to China and to again and again list China as a major rival to the U.S. In development. Now, there's nothing that China is doing that is threatening militarily to the U.S. It's that the Chinese economy is growing and expanding, and there's a whole network of trade relations. And that's threatening to U.S. economic domination on a global scale. So would they, as part of the pivot to Asia, cut off this important checkpoint in the Malacca Straits? They certainly might. And China's non-military approach is building a deep-sea port, an industrial park, and gas and oil pipelines that would take materials overland before it goes through the Straits of Malacca into the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-billion-dollar construction project. It's enormously beneficial to very seriously underdeveloped, impoverished Myanmar. So developing the gas fields there is extremely helpful to them. And suddenly into this comes a struggle where you have even President Trump at the UN. He's on the one hand threatening nuclear annihilation of people's Korea, and then he says that the people, the Rohingya population, demanding that the UN Security Council take strong and swift action, come to their defense, rally international support. And we see a movement that is based in Mecca in Saudi Arabia, being the group that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and groups around the world are suddenly demanding there be all-out support for. So there's some suspicion, is there, what's going on here?
Yes, yeah.
And is this really support that they're offering, or are they attempting to utilize an oppressed grouping and utilize it against the people of Myanmar and against the people of China, too?
Certainly the alleged, you know, U.S. interest in problems faced by people and in groupings and national minorities, it's very inconsistent when you look at it, and you even provide examples of that. But it is consistent in the respect of U.S. foreign policy and its interests. And it was very interesting context you laid out in part one of that article, why U.S. and Saudi Arabia back Rohingya in Myanmar. I mean, with reference to China, yeah, you were saying that it's, you know, it's a rapidly developing country that has many infrastructure projects, is able to engage with other countries. It's creating its own networks and trade relations and so on. It does not want to confront the U.S. militarily, and so it's trying to avoid confrontation. But we're ending up in these kind of situations, unfortunately. And then there's the issues here about the armed insurgency itself in Myanmar. So there's been patterns of coordinated series of attacks hitting a large number of government buildings. These are not the acts of a small group. And your article points out that there are many, many articles in Western outlets stating baldly that the Saudi government, Saudi Arabia, provides material support to armed groups within Myanmar. What can you tell us about that? We have then a situation where there is an armed group conducting armed anti-state activity, and it's supported by Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's what caught my interest, were the sheer number of articles that just make passing reference. And I'm talking about Reuters and the Chicago Tribune, Wall Street Journal, and also what's really a major corporate think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. None of these are radical publications by any means, but they all refer to Saudi support for the Rohingya struggle, and also quote that it's based in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army is based in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and that's who carried out this coordinated attack on 30 Myanmar military posts back in August 25th. Now, August 25th, that was important for another reason. It was the very day that the UN was issuing a report that ways to achieve a political solution for the Rohingyas. And here's the response at this effort to achieve a political settlement and announce it and publicize it. There is a coordinated attack on 30 military bases, which takes quite some coordination, as you can imagine. That's not just one policeman, one attack going on. The same day, attacks on 30 installations. And an attack that precludes then any kind of negotiated settlement. So clearly this is a force that doesn't want to resolve problems. And it is right and just to say that the Rohingya are an oppressed group within Myanmar. But it's also important to know, and this is never mentioned in the press, in the media here, they refer only to Rohingya and the rest of Myanmar being a largely Buddhist country.
Well,
the Rohingya represent about half of the, or a little less than half the Muslim population of Myanmar. But Myanmar is made up of 135 distinct ethnic groupings. There's eight major nationalities. And there is, generations, decades of struggles, many struggles by different groups within Myanmar and earlier within Burma. to establish national rights. So it's not the only struggle, but it's the only one that's suddenly come to the attention, the overwhelming support, the media support, or Trump calling out at the UN for the defense. That also is worth noting. The number of different national groupings that make up Myanmar today, which the British used as part of their imperial policy of conquest, of playing one group against another, and did so in an incredibly vicious way. I mean, the what was at the time called Burma, there were three wars that British imperialism protracted wars to conquer Burma. And the first Anglo-Burmese war was the most expensive war in British India's imperial in its history. They developed the strategic hamlet tactic, actually in what was at that time called Burma. The U.S. later used that very same brutal tactic in Vietnam. It meant that hundreds of villages were burned, the whole population uprooted into strategic hamlets, really concentration camps. And new British rice plantations were established. This totally uprooted the whole population of the country. Burma became the largest rice exporter in the world. More than half of all the rice in the world at the turn of the last century came from Burma. And it did not happen by a friendly policy. It came from strategic hamlets, concentration camps, huge plantations, the destruction of the economy that was there and turning it forcefully into the global market economy.
Well, for those who are just tuning in, we're speaking with Sarah Flounders, anti-war activist in the United States. Chances are, if there's any significant anti-war movement activity in the U.S., Sarah is involved with it. And, of course, I guess, you know, we all have a bad taste in our mouth right now from Libya and from Syria, where, you know, grievances of this or that group were used to justify very destructive outside military interventions. And that's the problem with the colonial legacy that we're discussing here, because as you pointed out, in Burma, Myanmar, and in other places outside of that country, of course, the British have left us all with this present where they have pitted various groups against one another and left countries in a state where they are divided among ethnicities and religions to make them weak and vulnerable to outside intervention, to make them dependent on imperial powers, to make them dependent on outside aid. And, you know, in the case of Myanmar, there are many groups involved here, and they could be pursuing a strategy of negotiation, of reconciliation, of recognition of problems, of addressing those locally. But having an insurgency backed by Saudi Arabia and rattling all these bells and alarms by the Western countries that's not a strategy for national reconciliation. That's not a strategy for, you know, ending problems or addressing or confronting issues. It's run about preparing some kind of nasty conflict, I think. And, you know, as you pointed out, it's all very, very dubious because the U.S. government, you know, President Trump, I suppose, they're positioning themselves as defenders of groups of Muslims within Myanmar. These are the same people threatening to bomb Iran, threatening, you know, putting sanctions on various countries in the Middle East and the Arab and Muslim world. They say they care about certain groups in Myanmar right now. Well, we got Saudi Arabia, as you pointed out, that's bombing Yemen. They are bombing and starving Yemen. They're killing, we don't even know how many people right now. As many have pointed out, the richest country in the Middle East, the Saudis, are bombing and occupying and starving the poorest country in the Middle East, Yemen. And this does not address or cause any international condemnation by the United States, by Canada, because the United States is intricately involved with this military operation in Yemen that it refuses to condemn. Can you tell us about this dichotomy here?
Well, maybe that's the clearest example of why we should be so suspicious about suddenly the great sympathy and support shown on the part of the U.S., on the part of Saudi Arabia, on the part of a whole series of NGOs that all too often, and I'm talking about Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, many others, who very often just reflect the State Department line when they're putting out an international petition. But right now in Yemen, there is what is what's called the world's largest hunger crisis, a man-made hunger crisis. That's how the Washington Post described it, where there's 7 million Yemenis that are in a real famine. And it's because of a U.S. naval blockade, number one, the aircraft that is bombing Yemen on a daily basis. Supposedly these are Saudi aircraft, but Saudi Arabia cannot fly their own planes without U.S. participation, satellite reconnaissance, in-air fueling, and so on. This is how even the wealthiest country is kept in a dependent position, where they don't really control their own air force. So in every sense, the war in Yemen is a U.S. Carried-out war, where their contractors and their military carries out every stage of it, including the in-air refueling and the naval blockade. So here's Yemen unable to get any imports, a country extremely dry and arid, that was the poorest country in the region already. And the destruction, especially the bombing of sanitation and sewage lines, has created a cholera epidemic. And that is something that can and does very quickly get out of hand. And according to UN figures, there's now 700,000, reaching toward a million, people with cholera in Yemen. Very treatable, with literally with pure water, with good drinking water.
Yes.
So you have a cholera epidemic, you have a famine going on, you have daily bombing, and it's not in the news at all. And then you have, instead, daily coverage and every administration official talking about another different, smaller crisis somewhere else entirely, where they're also behind it, but in a more secretive way.
We've seen the photos from Yemen. You can go on the internet and look. The starving children, they look like skeletons. It's all a preventable catastrophe, a preventable mass murder. People starving to death. 21st century, they have cholera. They don't have access to proper sewage treatment. They don't have access to food. They don't have access to water. And it's because they're being bombed and blockaded and sanctioned and invaded by Saudi Arabia. And now we're supposed to believe this is the Saudi Arabia that wants to liberate people in Myanmar. It's really, it goes again to the colonial legacy you referred to. Burma, some people still calling it Burma. That was a place where bad things happened. The British ran one of the most violent and destructive campaigns of all time in Burma to suppress resistance to British rule, to keep it in the empire in its orbit. Now, the British, the Anglos, the Anglo-American Alliance and the Saudis tell us they want to go and they want to liberate Burma. This is a country that has its share of problems. OK, yeah, there's oppression of groups. There's poverty. This is a place that has real legitimate problems. But the question is, how do you want to address those problems? Is an armed insurgency that relies on Saudi backing and a media blitz by the United States going to solve Myanmar's problems? What is the United States gearing up for in its giant media campaign about Myanmar? What are the avenues we have here? What can Myanmar do, or what can people do to try to get a solution that involves honest negotiation and dialogue and discussion between actors within that country, rather than turning this into part of this regime change traveling show that has flattened about 8 or 9 countries in the last decade?
Yeah, in any one week, literally, the U.S. is bombing some 8 different Muslim countries. So there's no concern we shouldn't give an ounce of credibility that this is based on concern for Muslim people in Myanmar. What they do want, though, are U.S. bases. And this has been a constant pressure on Myanmar. And one of the ways we could even look back at this demand for a military base, in 2008, what was called the worst cyclone of the century hit Myanmar. This was predicted many, many days before, but it created a huge tidal wave that hit the Irrawaddy Delta in Myanmar, in the Gulf of Bengal. And it created a wall of water 12 feet high that surged miles inland, and over a million people were left homeless. There was tens of thousands of people who were missing, and the Yangon, which is a former colonial capital, was just in a shambles. And at that very moment, President George W. Bush, passed a new round of sanctions on Myanmar that made it very difficult for international donations and international aid, and then demanded that U.S. aid be given, that the U.S. be given full military access to Myanmar to deliver and to coordinate emergency supplies. This was turned down by the government, even though it was desperately, desperately needed, because there's a deep sentiment in Myanmar against U.S. bases. But it really shows how cynically even a national catastrophe on a huge scale is suddenly used as an opening to demand a base and to say, well, we have a humanitarian catastrophe. They actually tried to get past to the U.N. Under this right to protect clause that they could forcibly go in and, quote, distribute aid. They didn't succeed. But it does show exactly what U.S., even when it's called humanitarian aid, is for. It's for military placement and domination of a region.
Really?
It's never meant for the improvement of the life of the population. They did the same thing, of course, in Somalia in a famine. It meant a U.S. base to deliver aid. And if it wasn't granted, then just stand by and let people, you know, die of famine.
And there I was thinking that the whole purpose of the U.S. military was to deliver aid in hostile areas. If they don't want your aid, well, that's why we got 12 aircraft carrier groups to make sure we can feed all those hungry people. Because that, if there's one long-standing U.S. policy, it's you got to feed hungry people, give them free food. That sums up the U.S. and Trump.
And it's the one thing they're incapable of doing right now in Puerto Rico. Here's a real U.S. colony since, 1898. And a little island, 100 miles by 40 miles, they can't seem to coordinate even basic electricity, let alone food or water. Any U.S. brags about how they have thousands of these big containers, which are what they call a base in a box. And in each container are generators, water filtration, tarps, field hospitals, medical supplies, ready meals, and so on. In each container, there are thousands of these.
Yeah, and somehow
it would take nothing to airlift one to every town in Puerto Rico. They just can't seem to do it.
No, they can't seem to do it. All their forces are tied up bombing Yemen and bombing seven other countries and having aid to deliver by force wherever necessary in the world, except Puerto Rico, which, it's allegedly part of the U.S. You want to see what a colony looks like, that, they don't have
that. Is right.
They don't have the money or the self-determination to be able to even rebuild. And they have to say, can you help us, you know, mother country that we're allegedly part of? And and Trump says, you guys just want everything done for you. You're a bunch of lazy bums. You know, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Compare that with Cuba. If you look at the disaster relief from that exact same hurricanes, how Cuba handled it, you know, they've already cleaned up a lot of the mess. They had been well prepared, well in advance. So, you know, they had big national programs to just move people out of the way of the hurricane, to distribute aid, to distribute food, to, you know, power down things that, you know, you don't want on fire. All those kind of things were all done in Cuba. You couldn't look for a more stark contrast. And there should be more articles on that. But I know you're going to be writing a lot on all these issues. And you've got, you know, two parts to this article already. Why U.S. and Saudi Arabia back Rohingya in Myanmar. We'll probably have to hear more soon because, you know, I think although there's many bad things happening, like, you know, U.S. gearing up possibly for another intervention this time in Myanmar. On the other hand, you know, you got a lot of people that are not you're just not taking it in the sense that
right. We're
not waiting around, you know, to see what happens. It's not like the outset of the crisis in Libya or Syria where we had to listen to all sorts of people tell us that, oh, there's a revolution and we got to support this and we got to let the U.S. in there and we need more bombs and we need more fighter jets, people are getting more impatient with these alleged humanitarian interventions and these things that we're supposed to support and just going into people's countries and solving problems through the application of external force, military intervention, support for insurgencies, you know, there's more and more resistance to it. And you're part of that, and you are raising awareness of some very important ongoing issues. So we're very happy about that. We'll be trying to catch more of your articles, read more of your articles as they come. This is very important work. We have to be on top of these things as they happen before the intervention starts so that we don't have to play catch up for years. So I really appreciate the work you're doing, and I look forward to reading your further work on this subject. So thanks very much for being on the program with us today, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Sarah Flounders, U.S.-based anti-war activist. You can find the recent article on workers.org. You can find some of her work on the International Action Center. I think it's IA Center, iacenter.org. Of course, you can find this program, Unusual Sources, and its new home on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website at hcsw.ca. That's hcsw.ca. There's a new radio section on the right-hand tab, and you can get our podcasts and programs and stuff like that. So keep an eye on the Sarah Flounders article. I haven't even read part two. I'm sure it contains all sorts of interesting context and background on the colonial situation, which is quite acute in Myanmar, former Burma.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report. the book we're going to talk about, but we're going to talk about two things when we get David on the phone. Is he on the phone? Are you there, David?
Yes, I am.
Oh, my goodness. I'm embarrassed. I didn't know we had called you yet. You've written a great book, another one. This is Kagame's Killing Fields. I think, by the way, one of the reasons the regime of Paul Kagame is unhappy with you, you have a knack for good titles and getting to the point. But I think you probably, like myself, want to talk about the type of rule that President Kagame uses, because this woman, Diane Rwigara, who wanted to challenge to be president, has now been arrested with her mother and her sister, and she's made a court appearance. If I understand rightly, she is due in court again tomorrow. This is a very urgent matter, so I know you would. This would be something that I'd say makes your point of the book, Kagame's Killing Fields. Tell us about her status.
Yes, thank you, Phil. The status of Diane Rwigara is that after challenging Paul Kagame for the presidency, she was barred from doing so. And then after Kagame won election by 99%, the regime decided to lock Diane and her family up in their house, after which for about a month, no one could access them. No one knew what was going on. And now then she has the family has made the two court appearances. The last one, as you rightly put it, was today. And what's shocking is that on both occasions when they appeared in court, the state was not able to state exactly what the charges are, beyond saying that Diane Rivera, Adeline, her mother, and her sister,
mm-hmm.
they have incited the population for insurrection.
Insurrection.
Against the government of Paul Kagame, which of course makes you wonder because this is a man who says that he just won elections by 99%.
Yes.
So how do you incite? I guess these women would be inciting the 1%. I don't know.
It would be suicide if she were. You'd say, "Well, go and campaign and see what happens."
Yes. So it's that's really the situation now,
mm-hmm.
as of today.
Pardon me?
As of today, that's the situation.
That is their position.
Yes.
Yeah, and now they have not been told the charges. It's a. I've seen the pictures. By the way, go to David Himbara Twitter and look at some of the photographs. She and her mother and sister really carrying themselves with great courage and dignity in a really ugly, frightening situation. Her mother held up her Bible and said, "I'm not afraid of anyone but God." It seemed very impressive. Given the way that this government treats people.
Actually, this family is extraordinary. The mother, the daughter. When Diane was trying to campaign, was trying for the presidency, her mom was always on her side with the same Bible, mm-hmm. that Bible. And don't also forget, Phil, that... this is the family that lost the dad. Diane Rivera's father died in a mysterious car accident 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when this same family demanded for an investigation, the government said no, but instead went ahead and demolished their hotel in Kigali. So yes. this is a family.
Their property's been taken.
Yes. So the family, as you say, really did fight. They're not backing down. They're not breaking up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The scenes in the court were also extraordinary because in the court hearing, she said, "Look. Tell us, what are the charges? Share with the defense the file of the charges."
Mm-hmm.
And the state prosecutor said that he's not willing to do that, and that's why they adjourned the case again until tomorrow.
Now, by the way, do I understand this could become a little awkward because isn't her sister also an American citizen?
Yes, Anne Rivera is an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Adeline and Diane, they are Belgian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know that one situation, families are always scattered all over, we all scatter, then you run here, become a refugee, get citizenship, and then go back to Rwanda and so on,
Mm-hmm.
So that's how over the years they have acquired a various citizenship.
Well, yeah. Ed, give us an idea of what, your book, The Killing Fields, of course, talks about all the various crimes like at Cubejo, which were perpetrated in the past, the attack on Tingi by the Rwandan army. This is a government that does not brook opposition, and indeed, it'll go into other countries, find people, and kill them. My memory was there was a huge prison population. Do you have any idea? I mean, there's all kinds of people out of the army, out of the clergy, for all walks of life who are in prison there, right?
If we're talking the crimes by this government, they tend to fall in three broad categories. There are those that are killed. There are those. If the numbers are significant, if there are more than 10, then you go now into massacre, the category of massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And the third category then would be disappearance. So the three broad categories, if you trace them, the killing, the massacre, the targeted killing, the massacre, and disappearances. If you trace the three broad categories from 1994 up to today, or rather after 2016, where we have the record,
mm-hmm.
This is absolutely shocking. Mm-hmm. Because really, first of all, in the categories of the mass killing, the massacres, the numbers of people that have died under this man's regime outnumber the combined deaths by all African dictators since independence. You are talking about Idi Amin, Mengistu, blah, blah, blah. If you Taylor in Liberia, if you combine all that,
mm-hmm.
The number of is pale because Kagame, in DRC alone, you're talking about 5 million.
Mm-hmm.
In Rwanda, remember also genocide he has handled because he provoked it. So if you count 1 million and then you go into Kibeho massacre a year after, you now get into the number, you get like 4,000 minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Disappearances. The number is quite a massive.
Mm-hmm.
Then the targeted killings. This is now when you go to political leaders, media, people like Karegeya, people like State Senator Chonga, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So. By the way, writing that book, you think that you know this all, but sitting down in for about 6 months, looking at this, nothing but this, it's absolutely shocking.
Yes,
and that's why you in a way you kind of in a very strange way, you come to admire the audacity of this man and his PR. Because here is a man who has done all that, but he's celebrated. The man who has built Singapore of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The man who has empowered women in parliament. Mm-hmm. He's a parliamentary majority.
Mm-hmm.
The man who has brought IT in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
The man now who is a leading peacekeeper across Africa and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely incredible.
Well, he's had a little help, as you mentioned. he does. He still enjoys the embrace of Tony Blair, who in a little bit of trouble himself, and Bill Clinton and people like that, who apparently, they don't want to lose him because if they lose him, then they themselves could be vulnerable. They seem to hang together like a gang.
Yes, but I don't know if it's my wishful thinking talking here, but I think finally more and more people are recognizing, are realizing the true nature of this man, Kagame. I noticed, for example, that after winning by 99% in the 98 voter turnout, none of those folks were congratulated him. I think they kept quiet. I think that may be saying something.
Might be a sign of something.
Yeah, I hope I'm not reading too much into it.
Yes. Well, I should remind our listeners, too, this is David Himbara, and please go to the Twitter, David Himbara's Twitter, because all the details there, and there are other links available. People need to inform themselves. The fact is, he's advertised, the way that his game works is that he is the savior, and then he created an economic miracle. But there's a nagging problem with the savior story, because yourself and others, certainly many others who served in his government, Mr. Rudasingwa for one, who said, well, but you see, if he's a savior, he has to remember that by shooting down the plane, which he's accused of doing, and it seems to be a consensus, then he not only would be the savior, he'd be the instigator of the crisis that swept across Rwanda called the genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see, these are some of the things that are beginning to come back, really slowly but steadily. What talk about this killing, for example, of shooting down the aircraft that marked the beginning of genocide. Well, you may recall that the two presidents who died, the president of Rwanda, who died in that crash, and the president of Burundi, who were ironically coming from signing peace agreement with Kagame Zarafier. Well, their widows took this matter to the American court, and against Kagame, there's this lawsuit there. Rather than challenging it or facing it, he got the Obama administration to get him to assert an immunity for him to keep coming to the United States. And then, of course, a year later, the Congolese government, DRC government, took Paul Kagame to International Court of Justice for killing 3 million people. So Kagame denied the court jurisdiction over the case. So in both cases, you see, Kagame is not arguing that he didn't do it. No. He gets his friends to save him.
Well, I always found his comments, people seem to forget, he, just as in the case of Patrick Karegeya, he almost laughed into the face of the world at the death of Karegeya and made really ominous and malevolent comments about Mr. Karegeya. He did a similar thing with the death of Habyarimana. I saw him in an interview in about 2000, and he said, why should I care if he died? He's my enemy. I don't care. And the answer would be because war is going to break out and thousands of people are going to die. But he just rhetorically said, why should I care? Well, that Mr. Habyarimana was your partner in a Arusha Accord. The two of you are trying to have a peaceful resolution. That would be the answer of why you should care, right?
But now we have a smoking gun. We know that he cares despite all that rhetoric. Or at least the weight of these crimes is beginning to weigh heavily on him. What do I mean by that? Well, in the constitutional amendment that allowed him to run for third term, that allowed him to run Rwanda for 17 more years until 2034, well, I think he showed a fear in there. The Article 114 reads as follows, that the president of Rwanda, after he retires, may not be prosecuted for the crimes he committed, including serious crimes and deliberate crimes, la, 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 la.
Mm-hmm.
So, here, of course, while he's in office, he has immunity. But now he has, he's now given himself impunity to keep committing crime. But more importantly, he needs an immunity after he leaves office from those same crimes. But you see, it just won't happen. Even if he puts in a crony that protects him within Rwanda, those laws don't have any bearing on international law. He'll face international law. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
Uh-huh.
So I think my reading of Article of the new Constitution, Article 114, I think he realizes that it's game over. He has to hang on to power or else.
Yes. They say, what is it, uneasy rests the king as every, he, it's hard to sleep knowing the people are out there.
Look at that. So Kwame Nkrumah, the African, the first independent president of Ghana, said that after he saw that his ministers were getting corrupt, he said that, look, you can buy a golden bed, but I don't know if you'll be able to sleep. Doesn't make a difference. Yes.
Yeah. Well, David Himbara, it's great talking to you. The book is Kagame's Killing Fields. I know it's available at a different book list, and it's a very good read, and I like it. I think it's full of information people need to have. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, soundcloud.com/Taylor-report, and facebook.com/The Taylor Report. And I believe we are joined, are we not, by Freddy Usabuera, pardon me. Are you there, Freddy?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. Forgive me, I stumbled over your name. But you have an organization. Actually, I'm going to ask you to say it because I want people to know about it. What's the name of the .org organization?
Yeah, the name is actually, thanks for having me, Phil, today. The name of the organization is Amahoro Iwacu 2017 Campaign, so which means Peace at Home 2017.
Peace at Home.
Peace at Home.
Okay.
Peace at Home.
So if they learn to say that, they'll be able to say in Kinyarwanda, Peace at
Home. Yes, yes. Yes.
I'll spell it out for them. It is AMAHORIWACU 17.org, right? Or is it just .org?
There is no.
No 17.
No 17. It's just amahoriwacu.org.
.org.
Well, yes.
Again, thanks for joining us. Now, you have taken up the campaign, the big one, of fighting for democracy in your country. But, of course, it centers partly around the two women that we've come to know, Victoire Ingabire, and, of course, more recently, Diane Wigara. You have quite a list of people, prominent Rwandans, who have been taken off the streets, badly treated. Some have lost their lives. Tell us about your organization and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yes, thank you very much, Phil. Actually, our campaign was launched in London in summer 2015. And that was an idea that was brought out by some Rwandan youth living abroad to see how we can bring about change in Rwanda, because we have a dictatorship that's oppressing the people there. And the reason being that in 2015, the news came out that Paul Kagame, the actual president, was planning to change the constitution in order to be able to go for a third term of a presidential election. And we found that it was not a good idea because of what's going on in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And we started campaigning, especially campaigning to Rwandans and also taxpayers in the countries we live in. Like myself, I live here in Canada. I am mm-hmm. a Canadian. We mm-hmm. pay taxes, and mm-hmm. our taxes end up going helping a government that's oppressing the people. And the aim of our campaign was to tell the taxpayers in Canada and abroad that, you know, they should call on the government of Canada, you know, to look closely to what the government of Rwanda is doing with our taxes, mm-hmm. which ended up to be, instead of being development aid, you know, Canada will send, or some other foreign countries will send money for programs for development and other things, you know, to help the mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. But then they use them to oppress the people, you know, buying arms and, you know, and putting out the police and going to catch people just, and, excuse me, and refusing them their rights, whichever, you know, basic rights, rights they can be.
Yes. Now, how do you feel? This is a difficult process. Now, I guess I should peg this also. You just had Ingabire Day, wasn't it,
yes.
This past Saturday? Just to underline
yes.
That there is international support for your work, and it, of course, focuses on her, and that she's been in jail now for, what is it, 4 years?
It's been 7 years right now,
Seven years.
Yes. And 7 years in jail for only having tried to present herself against Kagame in presidential elections in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for those who are following us, just a little bit history about Ingabire. She's a lady that lived outside of the country for over 16 years. And in 2010, she decided to go back in Rwanda. She arrived in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, on January the 16th.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to visit the memorial, genocide memorial. And in her speech, she called on, you know, the true reconciliation and peace for Rwanda, saying that all the people that lost their loved ones, you know, should be remembered. And from that day, she started getting in trouble because they said she was denying the genocide, which was not true. And it's just because they were afraid, because she was going to have a big impact. You know, she had so many funds in the country, and the pouvoir, you know, the government was afraid that she might just gain the election.
Indeed.
And then, yes, and she was on
democracy house. Might break out.
That's right. And then she was put on house arrest for a few months. And in October, on the 14th of October, actually 2010, she was arrested, officially arrested, and accused of trying to bring trouble in country, and also accused of denying the genocide, mm-hmm. wrongly accused. Okay, and that's the reason why on this Saturday, actually, there was an international day called Ingabire Day that was launched a few years ago by the Rwandan community in Lyon in France.
Mm-hmm.
And this time it was organized by together with other organizations like the IWNDP, the mm-hmm. International Women Network for Democracy and Peace. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Jambo ASPL, which is a youth organization in Belgium that it's a human rights organization. Amaho Iwachu, of course, which I represent here in Canada. Actually, I'm the spokesman for Amaho Iwachu here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Friends of Victoire in London. Mm-hmm. And AGLAN, that some probably of our listeners might know, the African Great Lakes Action Network in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a gala organized in Belgium on Saturday, and there was also one in London, and also South Africa, Spain, Austria. And yesterday, there was also another event here in Montreal organized by the IWNDP in that matter also, and it was also to recognize all those young people that have an impact in trying to change things in Rwanda. And the prize for this went yesterday to Diane Shima Rwigara, who's in jail right now because also she tried to run against President Paul Kagame
yes.
In the last elections in August.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So That's what happened.
And she also her mother and her sister, I believe.
Yes.
This is going to turn out to be rather interesting, too, because her sister is an American citizen. That might open one eye of the great power.
Yes, right. I actually feel thanks for bringing that on, because we are trying to call on people to call. She's an American citizen, and we are trying to tell people to try to call the White House or even the Foreign Affairs in the U.S. to ask that, they ask Rwanda to release their citizen, because what's happening in Rwanda right now, it's terrible. You know, people are oppressed because of their ideas. You know, there are so many political prisoners and also prisoners of conscience. And now there is this family here that has been wrongly accused after they killed actually their dad and also destroyed the hotel. You know, a $30 million value hotel was destroyed just in order to bring them to bankruptcy and to stop them of, bringing out what they know, and also to block Diana from presenting herself to the election.
Mm-hmm. This is Freddie Usubuera, and it's Amahori Wachu.
Amahori Wachu, yes.
Wachu. I'll spell it out again. AmahoriWacu.org. Please go to that site. You've been up against an information barrier, have you not? I mean, the work of people in the diaspora and others who care has been that we're facing a kind of a blackout, in that they don't want to hear in mainstream media, frankly, bad things about their ally, Mr. Kagame. Yet the bad things are piling up, right?
Yes. That's a problem I've been going through for the last 23 years. For all those listeners that are following, just to know a little bit about Rwanda, is being said to be one of the most growing economy in Africa, which is wrong. You know, that's totally wrong, because it has been proven that all the numbers that the government of Rwanda is putting out
David Himbara has an excellent book. What's it called? The Myth I forget the title, but he used to serve Paul Kagame as an assistant and as an advisor, and he showed that this economy is basically a fraud, that it depends on American money, basically.
Yes, actually, Rwanda is receiving, for the last 23 years, Rwanda has been receiving 40% of the budget of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. It's made of aid, and for the people to understand, you know, how come then, if the country is developing, is keeping getting money, you know, to run? That doesn't make sense. You know, because if a country is developing, that means there will be incomes coming from, you know, taxpayers and also. Mm-hmm. But Rwanda doesn't have those, you know, those things in place to make the country run perfectly. That's why they keep getting money. But the wrong side of it is that they get money and then they use it for something else, you know, especially oppressing the people. Yes. And that's the reason why, actually, in our campaign, you know, we are working hard to raise the awareness to the people, you know, so they can join us, you know, wherever they are, the lovers of peace and democracy, you know, to help us bring about peace in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. There is this issue of a government which it uses its position to define to criminalize opponents. So you pointed out that Ingabire Victoire returned to her country. She's a non-combatant. She was not in the country in 1994, but like other Rwandans, she lost loved ones. She cannot say what ethnic group they belong to, because that would be a crime.
That's right. And the other thing about Ingabire, because, you know, she's been living outside of the country, but she's been really voicing out to help, kids and women, you know. And she decides to go back to Rwanda because she believes that as a Rwandan, she can, you know, help and raise those issues and bring about democracy and peace. But she's a mother, actually. She's a mother of three. And ever since going in Rwanda, she's in jail now. They refused to even contact with her family and her kids. And she's still in jail. And something else I can bring up is she just brought her case and to the African Court of Justice for People's Court for Justice and Democracy in Africa. The People's Right Court in Africa.
Yes.
And now we are waiting for the decision. Mm-hmm. And at the time when she just went, she brought the issue there. Rwanda, being a member, decided to withdraw, which is very strange.
No, that was a great victory, frankly, because it shows which of them has the moral upper hand. Victoire, who put her case, was prepared to put her case, and to the court and the government of Paul Kagame decided to run over the hill and hide. It has to be encouraging to you for your work. By the way, her writings are available. If people go to AmahoreWatu.org, it's through there you can find her writings, right?
Yes, you can find her writings, and also on friendsofvictoire.org. That's another organization that has actually helped to publish on Saturday, her book that she wrote from jail, which is amazing. She wrote it in French, but now it was translated in English. But Friends of Victoire is the one that has done that tremendous job, and now the book is even available on Amazon. And the title of the book is Between the Walls of 1930s Prison. Mm-hmm. Because that's the name of the prison where she is. Uh-huh. So people can go and buy the book and read it, and know more about what's going on in Rwanda and who she is.
Yes. I'd like to say, it always strikes me, I see photographs ever, and we really ought to underline what courage it took for her to deliver herself into the hands of, a criminal government, in order to stand up for her people. I mean, this is extremely brave, and she's been in prison, now you say, for 7 years. And when I see her, her head is shaved. Are they still shaving her head? They go to the, is this
yes.
some sort of macabre exercise of theirs?
Yes, that's what they do. Actually, that's a type of humiliation, too.
Of course it is.
Yes. And, she's still there, and they still shave her head. And I remember that even before she went to Rwanda, she was here in Montreal. She came here. She made even some parliamentarian of the Canadian government and everybody else, some politicians here in Quebec. And I remember I was even at her press conference, and we asked questions telling her, how can you go? Because we know whatever's going to happen, they're going to arrest you or torture you. And she said straight that, no, I am ready. We can't just keep looking at and watching from outside, let our people suffer. She said to herself that she was ready for anything that can happen to her, jail or even to die, but defending the people of Rwanda and defending the human rights and democracy.
Well, I think Rwanda has a great future, but when it's going to have to mark her as one of the most heroic people in its history, Victoire Ingabire. Freddy Usubuwera, we're very grateful you could be with us, and I hope people go to AmahoreWatu.org, and we look forward to talking to you again. You obviously are going to be at this a while. This is going to be heavy work.
Yes, it is, and I thank you very much for allowing me to speak to your listeners and those who are following us. They can also contact us, sending us emails at info@amahoriwatch.org, and also they can follow us on Facebook.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. We'll be right back. This Way Out.
I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
I kept Denise in the closet for decades, and it was a great feeling for me when at age 49 I was finally able to have Denise come out for good.
We really wanted to focus on William John Banks' story, that story from 1841, but recognise that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A hunt for homosexuals begins in Burundi, true confessions of a self-made woman, and a historic exhibit ropes Brits into honoring the exile. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 14th, 2017. A homophobic virus seems to be spreading in more and more countries. We've told you in the past few weeks about Chechnya-like purges of gay people in Azerbaijan and Egypt. Police officials in Burundi announced an official hunt for homosexuals this week in their country. Several people, including teenagers reportedly arrested simply for dancing together, have already been jailed and forced to bribe officials to gain their freedom. Those who can't afford the extortion face beatings, heavy fines that they likely also can't pay, and up to 2 years in prison. President Pierre Nkurunziza announced the enforcement of a ban on homosexuality in Burundi's penal code in 2009. And according to Human Rights Watch, Nkurunziza is responsible for a spiral of political violence and widespread human rights abuses in the East African country. The youth wing of the ruling party is said to target opponents and perceived opponents who they kill, rape, torture, forcibly disappear, or ill-treat. The government has already shut down the most prominent Burundian human rights organizations.
LGBTQ people in Indonesia have been under siege for several months through frequent police raids that have been urged on by high-level government officials and blessed by top religious authorities. Even though President Joko Widodo has denounced anti-queer discrimination and same-gender sex is not specifically illegal in Indonesia, except in Islamic law-governed Aceh province, cultural disapproval has made it virtually impossible to publicly support basic human rights for sexual and gender minorities in the world's most populous, predominantly Muslim nation. A police raid on October 6th at a sauna in Jakarta that's popular with gay men netted 58 people. The detainees include four men from China, one from Thailand, one from Singapore, one Malaysian, and one Dutchman. Authorities said none of the foreigners would be charged.
Human Rights Watch reported that most of the people caught up in the raid had been released by the following day. Four men and one woman remain behind bars, however, and are charged with violating Indonesia's strict anti-pornography laws, which prohibit sex parties, distribution of pornography, sex with animals or corpses, and oral or anal sex by gay or straight consenting adults. 141 other people were arrested during the raid on a spa in Jakarta in May in what authorities called a sex party. Five suspected lesbians were arrested in June, and their names and a video of the raid were shared with reporters. And 12 women were evicted from their shared home in September because neighbors believed them to be lesbians.
The United Nations Human Rights Office condemned the escalating attacks on LGBTQ people in Azerbaijan, Egypt, and Indonesia this week. UN spokesman Rupert Colville told a news conference that arresting or detaining people based on their actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity is by definition arbitrary and violates international law. In all three countries, he charged, authorities have alleged that those arrested were involved in sex work, although in almost all cases the accused have denied such allegations or indicated that they were coerced into confessing involvement. Colville called for those governments to drop charges based on vague or discriminatory laws and to repeal those laws.
But the rights of transgender people have advanced in Greece. Parliament passed legislation this week that allows trans people to change their legal gender without having to undergo reassignment surgery or sterilization. It also eliminates a required psychiatric diagnosis of gender identity disorder. The law covers anyone aged 17 and older. Children between the ages of 15 and 17 will also have access to the legal gender recognition process, but they'll still need to get a certificate from a medical council at Athens Children's Hospital. While LGBTQ activists generally celebrated the relaxed regulations, they noted that further progress remains. Married trans people can change their legal gender only if they divorce their partner, and the law also still blocks access to legal gender recognition for transgender refugees and migrants.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
That was candidate Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention in July 2016. Of course, he neglected to include hateful domestic ideology in his protection promises. And the administration of President Donald Trump has been actively trying to overturn virtually every LGBT rights advance made during the 8 years of Barack Obama. In recent weeks, the Justice Department began arguing in federal court that anti-LGBT bias is not outlawed under provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination based on sex. Obama-era guidelines to protect transgender students were thrown out, and honorably serving transgender service members face involuntary discharge if Trump's proposed ban is enacted. This week, the administration set its sights on queer seniors and even the rainbow flag.
The Department of Health and Human Services has withdrawn a December 2014 directive assuring that same-gender spouses are treated equally to heterosexual spouses in long-term care facilities that receive Medicare and Medicaid funds. Most nursing homes and hospitals depend on that federal assistance to stay in business. The Obama-era directive was issued after the Supreme Court's Windsor decision overturned key parts of the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013, but before the High Court struck down all state bans on marriage equality in 2015. An agency spokesperson explained that the Trump administration believes it is no longer necessary to enforce the directive since the Supreme Court issued its nationwide marriage equality ruling. Several queer rights groups noted, however, that previous Supreme Court rulings have stressed the importance of specifically naming groups who are protected from discrimination to allow a non-discrimination law to have its intended effect.
Meanwhile, the first ever raising of the rainbow flag over federal land, scheduled for October 11th, National Coming Out Day, made history, with an asterisk, and in spite of efforts by the U.S. Department of Interior to spoil the celebration by pulling out of the dedication ceremony its officials had arranged. Equality activists speculated that Trump administration officials became uncomfortable with the advance publicity of the historic day. So the rainbow flag flies adjacent to the Stonewall National Monument, but the flagpole itself is located on land owned by New York City, and it's not the part of Christopher Park that constitutes the first national monument dedicated to queer rights created by the Obama administration in 2014. Veteran activist Ann Northrup, who was scheduled to MC the dedication ceremony, blasted the Trump administration shenanigans on the weekly Gay USA TV show she co-hosts with Andy Hum.
They think we are so disgusting and so filthy that they cannot even let a little rainbow flag fly on federal land. This is the smallest of our concerns, and yet so emblematic of how we are treated and how they want to continue to deprive us of any legitimacy as regular human beings.
In other news, it's now legal in the state of Mississippi for government workers and private businesses to refuse to serve LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. what critics call the most oppressive so-called religious freedom law in the United States, HB 1523, went into effect on October 10th after last-ditch efforts in federal court to delay its implementation were unsuccessful. The law spells out three underlying beliefs: that marriage is only possible between one man and one woman, that proper sexual relations occur only between married heterosexual couples, and that gender is an innate characteristic established at birth that cannot be changed. Initial reporting by local media outlets, however, predict that the actual impact of the law will be negligible, that only a handful of county clerks will refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples, and that the vast majority of businesses will not turn away queer dollars. Nevertheless, several LGBTQ legal advocacy groups are already petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court to review the constitutionality of the law.
And finally, President Trump tweeted in his late July edict proposing a ban on military service by transgender people that he arrived at that decision after consultation with my generals and military experts. Dozens of congresspeople sent a letter to Defense Secretary James Mattis this week asking for specifics. The October 10th letter was signed by 114 members of Congress, all Democrats, of course. Virginia Representative A. Donald McEachin wrote the letter and spearheaded the effort to get his colleagues to sign. "We seek information to discover the proof of where and when the Pentagon advised the president that this was the best idea for our country," McEachin explained in a press release. "If there is proof, then we can evaluate that. If there is no proof, then the president lied to the American people once again." Does anyone believe we'll ever see that proof?
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 14th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
You walk in the doorway and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like. And you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Britain's present meets the past, later in the program.
Whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find me a place in this world or I never belong, I gotta be me, I gotta be me. What else can I be but what I am?
Denise Dubois is a self-made woman, just like the title of her new coming-of-gender memoir. The book intrigued This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trackle with the same stories that first captivated the author's friends.
Starting back in 2008, 2009, sitting in the comfort of friends' living rooms in Portland, Oregon, where I reside, I would occasionally tell stories about my life as a transgender woman, things that happened to me in life. And people became so engrossed in my storytelling, they would say to me over and over again, "Denise, you should really write a book. You really should write a book." And I would always go, "Oh, yeah, 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 I'll write a book. I'll write a book." And I sat down in 2010 out on the North Shore of Kauai, and I started writing my book, and I wrote for the next 4 years. And when I finished, I had a manuscript of 650 pages. So, of course, the final book is nothing near that. It's 220 pages, but I was so excited to have my book published. I never expected that to happen the way it came down.
The gist of it is your journey as a trans person. And it's very adventure-filled, I must say. So, you know, maybe give people a little teaser of what they can expect to read.
My book goes back to the late 1950s when I had my first memories of being transgender at age 4, when I nearly drowned at my grandparents' lake cottage in southern Wisconsin. I was rescued. Had to wear one of my cousin's dresses when my clothes were drying. And that's when I knew that I was transgender. As soon as that dress was on me, I had this feeling. It was like just this revealing moment in my life where I felt proper and in the right role for myself. I knew that this was my future. It was a very difficult time, even at that young age, because my parents, as I began to exhibit transgender behavior, really tried to shut me down. And as a consequence, I found myself retreating deeper and deeper into a closet that was very hard to come out of, which is why it took me decades to break that routine that I'd found myself in. I had quite a male persona that I'd built up around myself all those decades. As a consequence of all that, I ended up using a lot of drugs and alcohol. I survived. I found a way to pull myself together, and I found a way to come out at age 49, 1 month shy of my 50th birthday. I went to Bangkok for my gender-affirming surgery, as it's called today. And since that time, life just opened up for me. It was such a great thing. My book does take you around the world in many different places. I tried to be as genuine and honest as I could in my book. I put it all out there is what I'm trying to say, and I didn't hold anything back. And so there's a lot of graphic language in my book of things where I found myself in very dangerous situations, and I managed to pull myself away from all that as well and survive.
Have you tapped into other trans writers?
When I first started writing my book, there were suggestions to me from others, you should read this book on transgender, you should read this person's book on their story. And I kind of made an effort, a promise to myself, to stay away from reading other stories. I just wanted to write my own story.
Are there any questions that I haven't asked you, you wish people would, or things you want to say that I didn't ask?
For decades, I kept Denise in the closet. I didn't really have much of a choice in my life, and I had to do that. And it was a great feeling for me when at age 49, I was finally able to have Denise come out for good. So what was the first thing I did? I kicked Dennis in the closet for the next 12 years. And how fair was that to Dennis? Because here's the deal. Denise is always going to occupy center stage for the rest of her life. But I've realized that there should always be a bit role for Dennis on that same stage. Never forget where you came from. Never forget who you are. Always be your true self. And that doesn't matter if you're transgender or not. Just be sincere in your life. Be honest with others. Care for others. Learn to love yourself so you can learn to love others. That's one of the most important lessons in life. And being able to forgive others is another great lesson to learn in life that I'm still at times struggling with, but getting there. When you find and accept yourself for who you are, you could be a much better person to others in this world. I have a terrific website. I've been interviewed from here to Poland. That's all posted on my website, so selfmadewomanbook.com. Please join me there and follow me as I travel, hopefully the globe.
I gotta be free as the breeze, just wait and see.
Self-made woman author Denise Dubois was interviewed by Dixie Trykle.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
The moving historical exhibit is stirring a range of emotions in the UK. This Way Out correspondent Mary Milton takes us there.
I'm at Kingston Lacey, a National Trust property in Dorset. It was the home of William John Banks until in 1841 he fled to Italy in exile in order to escape prosecution for homosexuality. Today, the National Trust are proudly flying the rainbow flag, and I know inside there's an exhibition to honour William John Banks and to tell his story. I'm here to see that, and to meet the people who've designed it.
My immediate reaction walking into Kingston Lacey is, wow, you really don't mess about with the message here. I'm with Richard and Julie, who've put this exhibition together. Julie, tell me where we are and what this represents.
This is the entrance hall of Kingston Lacey. This is the beginning of the Exile Project. And you walk straight into this, what we call transitional space, where people leave and people come in, into 51 thick manila rope pieces hanging from a wooden structure. And they each represent a man who was killed under laws of the criminalisation of homosexuality at the time of William John Banks, who lived in this house. So throughout his life, 51 people, 51 men were killed under laws of the time. So,
and we've been interrupted by a voice now that's reading names.
They're the names of these 51 people, and they've been read by the staff and volunteers of Kingston Lacey in workshops that we held to include everybody who is currently in Kingston Lacey in this exhibition.
That was really important to us to have that collaboration because it makes them human. These were people who were brothers, fathers, they were family members. And when you hear the voices from men and women, young and old, living today, it hammers home that these were not just names from the past. They are people, real living people with connections, lives and loves, and we really wanted to make that a very human story.
Shall we move in further to the exhibition? We've left the ropes, which were hugely, hugely dramatic, I have to say. Just seeing them as you come through the entrance hall, it made me think of things that are happening today as well. And you've continued that throughout the house, that theme.
Yeah, we really wanted to focus on William John Banks' story, that story from 1841, but recognise that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today. And that's something we really try and surface in this room that we're in now, which is called the Spanish Room.
This room is possibly where we feel closest to William John in this house. It is absolutely opulent, gold, and most of this came from when he was in exile. Most of these paintings, most of the leather work, the gold leather work, he wasn't here to see this. What we're looking at are three Georgian windows that look out over his estate. The central one has been photographed and filmed to create this projection. You look through this window and the landscape changes. This is like a stage looking out to the rest of the world. And we see other people's words and experiences and locations come up. So we can get reminded that this is actually happening in other countries today.
We should say a little bit about William John Banks' story as well. So he inherited this house and then he was caught in a compromising position with a soldier, is that correct?
Yeah, twice.
Right, so okay, so there wasn't any doubt about this.
There wasn't any doubt about this story. The first time he was caught, that went to trial, and he was acquitted. And it was a few short years later when he was caught again with a guardsman in Green Park. And that time, there was a sense that he might not have been so lucky. So he didn't risk that. He didn't go to trial. He had 12 days, as I understand that, and in that time he organised his affairs, and he fled.
Derek and Gordon, you didn't know the exhibition was on today,
no,
did
you? You walk in the doorway, and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It's very emotive. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like, and you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah. It could have been us, couldn't
it?
It
could have been us. Yeah. But that's how it's changed.
When you come to places like this, how often do you see the LGBT story told, your story?
This is the first.
The first time, yeah.
This is a first. It's a new groundbreaking.
What does it mean to you that the National Trust can do this?
Very special. And we've come on it by accident today, really. It's very nice. I've never known anything like this before, really.
51 bodies.
50, yeah.
You can see them.
We feel that it's like those people, they've lived, and yet they've been done out of their lives. In history, that 170-odd years ago, just like yesterday, really.
Drop in the ocean.
And it's not like today, is it?
Because no.
Today,
no.
Things are different.
Yeah.
Things are so different.
Yeah.
So different.
It wasn't like that.
It just shows you
how far we've come from.
Yeah. It's amazing, is it? I mean, you guys are married now, aren't you? Recently married.
Yeah, this year. Yeah. On your 60th birthday, we got married, didn't we?
So those two gentlemen to come in and connect like that, they can make a connection they wouldn't have been able to have done prior to Exile being on here. It's very heartwarming to see people be recognised and acknowledged, and they've taken advantage of the law to be married. And they talked about, you know, 100 years ago they couldn't do that. It's painfully recent.
Normally you kind of do projects like this and you hear for the preview and then you leave, but the three of us, Tom, Julie and I, really wanted to stay around and see people's responses. I don't think we quite expected the power for a lot of people. There's been some very, very emotional responses we've just seen, and we've seen it from staff too. And it is blow away, really. Yeah, really, really hard hitting. You've probably seen that the whole Prejudice and Pride programme has attracted some controversy and some negativity, and it reminds us why it's really, really important to do it. And then when you hear responses like that, it really underscores why it's important. And the National Trust's its values are very clearly stated, that to be forever for everyone, and what that means is really being there for everyone and welcoming people and enabling, like, those two guys to have the experiences that they've had.
Does that sort of reaction, does that make it worthwhile?
It does. When we started this project, I hadn't fully realised what an emotional journey it would be for us as researchers and colleagues here in the Trust. It has been extraordinarily personal at times, so that is very, very encouraging. We shall leave at the end of the day knowing that the project, at least with some people, has achieved what we really wanted it to.
The Exile installation is open every day until the 12th of November. To find out more about Kingston Lacey, go to www.nationaltrust.org.uk.
Our thanks for that report to Mary Milton. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Dixie Trackle, and Mary Milton. Ella Fitzgerald and Adam Lambert performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Arisha Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, KSPC Claremont, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If the state, the nation state, isn't working, isn't on the side of social justice, then what do we do? Do we seek a return to the welfare state, or do we work towards something else? Do we confront the state head on, or do we work around it by creating pockets of community that put into practice values different than those propagated by neoliberal securitized regimes? Robert Latham is a political theorist who's written a provocative book about what has worked and what is working today to foster fundamental social transformation. In The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state, Robert Latham puts forward a notion of recollective passage, which involves turning away from dominant socio-political relations and enacting new ways to organize and reorganize collective life. The book is framed as a dialogue between Latham and another person, a fictional policy analyst named Mr. V. Robert Latham is an associate professor at York University in Toronto, where he teaches in the political science, communication and culture, and social and political thought programs. When Robert joined me from a studio on the York University campus, I asked what he saw as the overall project of his book.
It really starts from two different political perspectives. And one perspective on the part of this Mr. V is a commitment to the social democratic state and society, a desire to return to what was understood as emerging out of the earlier 20th century from, let's say, the Great Depression onward and the FDR regime and all the various welfare state concepts and practices that came about, and a commitment to an emerging post-war celebration of labor and rights and work that was part of this bargain that took place after the war, the Second World War, versus another attitude which says, well, we really can't go home again, so to speak, that not only was the social democratic state or welfare state or liberal democratic state seen as resting, let's say, on an imperial system and on deep exploitation of labor and racism, sexism, go on with those sort of lists. On the other hand, it really doesn't work for advancing human progress, rights, justice, equality. And that's the basic starting point of the book.
Tell us more about what you don't like about welfare capitalism, about, you know, the social democratic state as you've defined it. Because a lot of people would say, well, you know, that was a pretty good time after the New Deal. And, you know, there was sort of a, you know, workers were treated better and there was less inequality. There was a more egalitarian distribution of income and wealth back then, let's say in the 1950s. So why don't you want to go back to that system?
Yes, I think there was more equality just because there was less inequality, which has become obviously much more pronounced and profound now. But as I mentioned, if you think about all the various forms of racism and exclusions that took place, not only for, let's say, Aboriginal communities, Native Americans, but for African Americans, Latinos, what was underneath all of that, mostly white privileged celebration of working class or middle class sort of white collar, that the disparity of their pay compared to the top executives was not as great. What actually sat there was a profound sense of inequality, great limits that were put on what could happen and what could not happen, what the possibilities were. I mean, we're in the middle of a Cold War. Most of this welfare state was actually operating with the Cold War, enacting the Cold War, emerging out of World War II. So war footing for this, the military-industrial complex was a strong part of it. Deep entrenched bureaucracies, large corporations that were roaming around the world exploiting resources and communities, millions and millions of deaths, destruction. So for me, that is enough of a kind of damnation for it to say, wait a second here, just going back to that and just returning there doesn't seem to work. So that's the problem I see, basically, and whether or not we can actually organize differently, think in different ways in terms of harnessing the energies on the left. That's the other side of it, where let's really take seriously these possibilities other than that return to the welfare state.
Now, you find hope in what you call recollective passage, and we'll be focusing a lot on that term and what it means during the course of the hour. But I want to start with deployments, because you speak of a sort of passage away from deployments. If we start with that term deployments, do you mean by that the array of forces deployed by the state?
Yes, exactly. That's what I see as the core logic, that really, if you think about the state, we can understand it, obviously, in legal and symbolic terms, and, you know, all sorts of forms of institutionalization and organization of an identity for a territory and forms of power and military force and so on. There's that level. But there's also the material level of the state, which has been emphasized for a long time, in 150 years. I mean, Marx and many other radicals of the 19th century, including some of the anarchists, made a lot of effort to pinpoint these things, the courts, the military, the police, and so on, all these various institutions, these real material forces that we might call, you know, forces on the ground. And if you think about the state, that it's really present through a deployment, some center, and typically, I'd say in the U.S. case, Washington, D.C., sends a piece of itself, some office somewhere, to another space. It's not unlike, in some way, the way that you see a imperial force sends a piece of itself, an army, a colony, to another space. So some, the federal government, for example, sends a certain office and group out to North Dakota, opens up a certain office, right, enters that space. So this is really how it's organized in a material way. If we look around, well, where's the state, right? We see it in these various pockets of bureaucracy, of administrators, of offices. So those are deployed. And I'm using that word just to convey the military sense, right? We talk about military deployment. So it's a way of understanding the state as a kind of quintessentially military form. And because of that, it raises the problem of whether or not, however well-intentioned and however justice-oriented your approach to the state is, if you're resting on that model, if that's how you're going to always relate to individuals, to communities, to spaces, then that's going to cause a problem for anybody who's seeking actually to change things and see the real justice that they're after.
Now, the state, the nation state in the U.S. and many other nations operates under what's called a neoliberal economic regime. It's not just an economic regime, a neoliberal economic political regime. And you write the passage starts from conditions like neoliberalism. Let me get your definition of neoliberalism.
I take neoliberalism as a, and there's many ways to understand it. I can't go through it, but I understand it in a sense intuitively as an attempt to harness the state to advance financialization, privatization, corporate power, the use of all forms of the state's apparatus, from infrastructure like water, electricity, for the advantage and the benefit of corporations. In some cases, it is so-called marketizing things, creating a market for something. For in many cases, we're not dealing with really markets. We're dealing with corporate power, very hierarchical forms of control, inside deals made between parties of the state, parties of corporations. And that, to me, is a kind of essential way of understanding it, and also intuitively to see what's really going on here in the end and what's different from a non-neoliberal form where you're actually dealing with, let's say, forms of public control of resources, bounded sectors where corporate power cannot enter or be determining or taking over resources and shaping the actual economic life and so on. So that's where there's a difference. So not that under non-neoliberalism, pre-neoliberalism, there wasn't lots of corporate power and capital was not essential. It's just that it reached a point where it could go into the state and, in a sense, use the state for advancing all of the things I mentioned, the privatization and the advancement of corporate power and so on, the colonization of sectors of life, for economics, for consumption, and so on, for finance, massive systems of finance and complicated arrangements that we associate with things like derivatives and forms of debt and so on. Those were all part of the package. And I think that was the kind of revolution that was central in neoliberalism, was to say, wait a second, it's not just about, you know, having more markets and arguing for markets in distinction to the state. It's about, let's go into the state. Let's really now exploit it. And lots of state exploitation happened through the centuries. And you can look at some of the histories of the 19th century and see what happened with railroads and canals. And we have depressions in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where we see massive financial power at play. But this became a systematic transformation. And it obviously was global. And it was really became organized as a way of doing things differently, not just pockets of difficult and troubling outcomes with large financial firms and J.P. Morgan or large corporations and Mellon and so on. This was of a different order. Continuous with that past, of course, but a sort of qualitative shift that became quite different.
Robert Latham joins us on Against the Grain. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto. And he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. It's recently out from Routledge. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica. And to continue and perhaps begin to wrap up our discussion of some foundational issues or aspects, hypersecurity, so that, again, you write the passage, which is what you're interested in describing and advocating for in this book, starts from neoliberalism and conditions like hypersecurity, By which you mean?
Yeah, hypersecurity, again, like neoliberalism, there's a major shift, a qualitative transformation in the treatment of security as internal to forms of life that hadn't been, in a sense, subject to it the way it had in the past. So most obvious example is all of the forms of surveillance that are being carried out by organizations like the National Security Agency, and we obviously see the revelations of Snowden, Edward Snowden. We've seen interesting things from WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers of various form. That's entering into a level of security that is much greater than it was in the past. It's also with hypersecurity, as I term it, we're also, in a sense, making it far more central a category for any government agency to actually evaluate what they're doing or not doing and making judgments about what's at stake, understanding the border. It's not just about governing a population, but carrying out very intensive security policies, and we're seeing that now today maybe carried to a extreme of the Trump administration. And it's a good example of, if you look at a interesting little antidote, if you look at a movie from 1950s and you look at border crossing, you'll see people basically showing up in some cases, let's say from Mexico, in their car and saying, oh, I'm an American citizen. Okay, where do you live? And maybe looking at a document and perhaps not even just going based on what they understand to be an American accent. That versus what we now see at the level of scrutiny and so on tied to security logic. So that's a pointed example of what we're talking about. We've reached a different level, just like with neoliberalism. It's continuous with the history of capitalism, but it's shifted and organized in a different way that we can understand as a qualitative difference, and the intensification is noticeable.
So, you know, we have all these things, these systems, these regimes that you don't like. And a lot of people would say, in fact, the interlocutor, your interlocutor in this book, The Politics of Evasion, which is framed as a dialogue between you and an imaginary Mr. V, a fictional Mr. V, he believes that then what you need to do is you need to take the state and get rid of it in its current form and replace it with something much better, more socially just. And yet, in this book, you are advancing a notion of passage, as I mentioned before. Is this a passage away, a movement away from the circumstances and institutions you've been describing?
Yes, that's a good way to look at it. It is a movement away. I mean, the image I always keep in my mind is like a black hole. Think of a plane of some space. Let's say that plane is social and political life, let's say, in the United States. And you open up a space, you try to break away from that plane, and the sort of hole opens up and you move away into another future. Now imagine that plane becomes populated with lots of these kind of black holes, so to speak. And the terrain starts changing. You start transforming. And so the reality of what's faced by any political actor, economic actor even, is changed. So it's different. That it's no longer as coherent as it once was. So those passages are about trying to move. I use the word deflection, deflect away, doing something different, sort of bouncing off of the existing form, deflecting from, turning away from that existing practice. And there's very mundane examples and very complicated examples. One of the most simple examples I ever think of is community banking. Think of a group in, let's say, the Midwest, a community that says, well, we're going to send our money to Wall Street. We're going to keep the money in the community or in the state, the region, the county, and so on. That's a deflection. You've now shifted. Now imagine that we had lots of these things going on. You saw an explosion. There was a scale-up of this practice. And as we know, there are organizations that are trying to advance this. And there is a history of this that goes way back, even into the 19th century, in terms of farms and the granges and so on. But imagine that we start to see a real kind of proliferation. So that terrain begins to shift. In a sense, the holes begin to emerge. It's no longer as coherent as it was, let's say, if you're sitting
somewhere in a large bank, and you're thinking of why are we now missing these funds, or why are these communities organizing differently? Why are they spending in different ways, and why do they have access to the money? Why is it not in our accounts the way it was 5 years ago? Why are they not borrowing from us? So that begins to transform. So that's one level of the passage, and there's the more radical dimensions as well. But that's another story where it goes from the other sort of arc of recollectivization, moving from the mundane example to the far more complicated examples of, let's say, large-scale social revolutions, like, let's say, in Cuba or other places.
So you would call the Cuban Revolution an example of what you term recollective passage. What is the recollective part of that phrase? What does that mean?
The recollective really reflects the notion that any group collective that's, in a sense, trying to deflect away, do things differently, finding a logic of difference, or finding lots of logics of difference, in the case of, let's say, Cuba, they're moving in another direction. They're reorganizing. They're devising other ways of organizing all the sectors of their life, their material and possibly cultural life. They're reforming their collective. Now, that's clear in terms of a large-scale revolution, as in the Cuban case, but they're also recollectivizing when that community, let's say in, you know, North Dakota, decides to set up a community bank. They are organizing it differently. It's a much more shallow version of it, and it's more, let's say, one-dimensional, dealing with, let's say, collective funds that the community has, but it's also a transformation. It's recollecting. Now, so this is sort of this kind of wide range or arc of recollectivity, as one might say, starting from narrow or mundane to the far more radical and wide scale. But what's unique is the attempt to point to this deflecting and devising away. So recollectivizing also reflects the idea that we would look back at existing resources that are our histories, what we have, the thing, our lands, whatever, homes and things, and reorganizing that to recognize them for what they are, bring them into this new collectivity that we organize. So it's not just a open to the future and the past means nothing. It is also something where the past does mean things, but it gets put back into reconsideration and reorganizing through this attempt to think of the collective and sit down with all of our existing forms and resources and material forms of life and cultural and symbolic, and saying, how can we organize this differently where we, the large collective, is treated in an equal way, in a just way? And the idea is also the re-notion, and where the passage comes in that's very important to that, is that it's moving into the future, that has to be left open. Open into the future, it's a never-ending process. Once you decide that it's over, we've done. You know, we're finishing here, this is good enough. Then, in a sense, you've stopped that possibility of recollectivity. You've, in a sense, you've formed, and you're just trying to consolidate and make it better, which risks not just the power of the bureaucracy taking over and just saying, well, we're going to administer life as is, but power forms, individuals, groups emerging who are saying, well, we're the ones that we're going to decide how this works best. We are the experts and so on. You really don't have any say because there's nothing open anymore. The way the world is this. So, and the thing is, when you mentioned Cuba, I mean, the cases in a sense, they did decide, okay, this is how it is basically. I think they kept to some degree going on, but in many ways they kind of locked in the system. So that's the key, is despite our desire for, let's say, the radicality of the early Cuban Revolution, the question is, can it keep moving and changing and transforming despite also the conditions that it always has to face? It's not easy. It's not something where people are just sitting around putting their things together and rethinking. They're facing lots of pressures. They're facing lots of counter forces, counter-revolution, constant challenge, fight back, and so on. So though the key is how one keeps things open, how does the collective, how does the individuals a part of this departure and that are going down the passage, how are they always feeling? Hey, wait a second, we can sit down and we can organize this way, we can organize that way. Or some of the examples during, let's say, Chavez's time in office, where there were lots of these communes and various organizations that were constantly operating with this kind of logic, I think.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham joins us. He teaches in the Political Science, Communication and Culture, and Social and Political Thought programs at York University. He's the author of The Liberal Moment and, most recently, The Politics of Evasion, a Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. Robert joins me today to talk about his new book, The Politics of Evasion. So, recollective passage. Nothing personal, Robert, but it's a bit clunky and it might not grab people and catch on, but maybe it will, and maybe this conversation will help in that process. Why create a new term and concept, in a sense, although maybe I'm beginning to answer your question for you, but why create this new term when we have terms already like social revolution or radical social movements or prefiguration, which is often used to describe the effort to point to and put into practice desired ways of living and organizing, which I think must be part of recollective passage. Why create this new term and not just piggyback on an existing term?
The main motive is to, one, find some of the common elements among all the different forms that you just described, and to distinguish those common elements from the things that fall outside of that. So if we can see the common elements between a social movement that is trying to change the logics of how things are organized, they change the way the border is organized, or do something as simple as change the way land and how people live, you know, say the squatters movement. That could be related to, let's say, large-scale revolution or back to the community banking to see that common element, which is that recollectivity. And perhaps recollectivism or recollectivity may be a better way to think of it than just the notion of the passage. I mean, the idea of the passage is just to emphasize that this is meant to move through the future and meant also to show that these things have to have a certain bounding. And I use the word shielding in a way because we can't just assume everything's going to be fine and open and not to be subject to forms of capture and forms of subversion by the state, various other forces that would want to do that. So these passages, and I'm in a sense inspired in that way by Walter Benjamin in his thinking of the passages, and he just was looking at commercial passages in France particularly, but also in his work and thinking, he pointed to the way these things got subverted, sometimes used in revolt and rebellion, or the way workers had used the passages differently than they had been intended and so on. So, but the idea of the passage is that you are moving into the future, that you have an existing trajectory, that you're on a trajectory of transformation. So social movements, for example, organizing to, let's say, push for better policy on CO2 emissions or something of that nature, or water pollution, or let's say a change in the wage of something. Those are, in a sense, different. Those type of pressures on policy, distinct from this idea that we're actually focused on changing the logics, how things work, how they're organized. And sometimes, again, they can be small. So, again, thinking of the community banking example or the wide-scale examples of, let's say, the Paris Commune, where they consciously there in 1871, you know, kind of 72, were organizing for this. And basically, once they finally got into their autonomy during the Commune, they were able to, in a sense, totally change the nature of how decisions are made, democracy operated, the relationship between what could be seen as representatives and the people, wages, and so on. They completely transformed that. So that's the emphasis. So The recollectivity is trying to emphasize that. That's different than, let's say, for example, a revolt or a rebellion or something like L.A. 1992. You know, important expression of terrible frustration, anger, and politics as well. But it's quite different than this idea of people self-consciously trying to move forward in transforming and putting the emphasis on those changes in transforming and things that actually say we are changing the collectivity, whether it's a small organizational thing or a large one. As I mentioned, it's still part of the same basic distinct form that's quite different than these other protests or types of mobilizations or networking to pressure, right, or marching down the street with banners and so on. I'm not in any way denigrating any of those other forms. I'm just pointing to something distinct that also is operating in these forms, let's say, broadly speaking, of resistance and attempts to transform social life.
But it's not just people who, let's say, reside on the left who want to change society, who want to transform power relations or, you know, social relations. I mean, there are a lot of people on the right. There are a lot of libertarians who want a transformation of society and are working toward it and are mobilizing and are in some cases demonstrating. Do these folks also fit within your passage idea?
Well, in a sense, they do at the very beginning, the starting point of saying, well, yes, this is attempt to reorganize. The problem is that they don't really have an interest in being recollective in any way, right? They want to achieve a certain type of society, and then they're done, which may resemble what we were talking about in terms of inclinations on the left that also want to achieve one certain sort of society, one way of organizing, and then kind of done, right? And if you look at any, you know, let's say Iran or the Iranian Revolution, 1979 and so on, they weren't seeking to open up a passage, a form of transformation going forward, of recollectivizing, of recollectivity. They were interested in creating the society that we have been watching unfold in the last decades. Any other movement on the right, let's say a conservative movement, the very notion of being conservative is about conserving, to create a certain type of society. Fixed notions go in. Yes, they change organizational logics, but they're really only interested in creating the particular form that they have modeled and so on. So, yes, as they go along, of course, they'll make changes, they'll do reforms and so on, but they're after one particular model. So the idea of the recollectivism is really about keeping it open so that the people, if I can use that term, are always, in a sense, and have to be open to possibly of changing again, holding things open to question and having the ability to say, wait a second, this is not going the way we intended, or this is leaving us out, or it's excluding us, it's non-democratic and so on. This has nothing to do with the two examples that I have in mind that I mentioned before with, let's say, certain forms of conservative right or the Iranian religious forms, very deeply Orthodox forms, right? They're exactly in the other direction, even though they open up a space of transformation. So they do change. They create one moment in a sense of recollective, in a sense, and it's over. So there's no passage, which is why having that qualifier of passage in a sense to understand what real recollectivism rests on is the ability to keep going into the future, always putting things at stake and always leaving up that possibility, leaving open that possibility of yet again transforming. So I think that helps to distinguish what we understand as kind of right revolutions versus, let's say, left revolutions. And the left, I think that was very much consistent with many things that Marx had said, in the sense of not being willing to say, well, here's what the new society should be, and criticizing any group and any ideologues that try to say, here's what it is, here's the seven principles, and let's just put them into action. And he had ideas of how it should be, notions of communal relationships to land and resources and so on, and the nature of work. Yes, he had principles, but that was different than actually modeling a society. So he was a real recollectivizer in a sense, in his logic, I would argue.
That's the voice of Robert Latham. He's associate professor of political science at York University, and he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. We'll take a short break and speak more with Robert about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham, he teaches in the Political Science, Communication and Culture and Social and Political Thought programs at York University. He's my guest today, and his new book is called The Politics of Evasion. It's recently out from Routledge. And on againstthegrain.org, you will find a link to his faculty page. It's L-A-T-H-A-M, by the way, his last name. You'll find a link to Robert Latham's faculty page at York University, as well as to the book, The Politics of Evasion. So by stressing, Robert, a kind of movement away from this system of neoliberalism and hypersecurity, as opposed to maybe a more confrontational approach, an attempt to maybe take down the state, you know, it smacks of anarchism, right? It smacks of being anti-state, not just anti this state, this neoliberal state, but not really not wanting a state in place. Is that fundamentally where your political instincts lie?
Not quite. I'm really, I say, on the cusp of both anarchism, socialism, and seeking ways that we can really learn from both of the traditions. And I think that really one of the key things for me is to recognize that, and as David Harvey, I think, pointed out, if I recall correctly, that even when you start talking about federation and you start talking about reaching a level where you have, let's say, autonomous communities that we understand in a kind of anarchist way that are trying to connect to each other, right? Because people aren't going to just sit there in their local communities and not try to create a world, a region, and so on. They have no choice. I mean, to survive and so on, and to enrich their lives, they want to be doing that. Once you get to that level, then you start possibly actually, in a sense, recreating a state, even if you don't call it that. You start having rules for relationships, for exchange, and so on. So I'm really working in my mind at that juncture where we really can't necessarily get to the point where we have a sort of pure anarchism per se. We work at the cusp, and I think it's an interesting place to be because it opens up the best of what we can bring from anarchism and best that we can bring from even notions of state socialism. And I think there's a way of understanding the state differently, that we don't have to have the state of deployments, the one that we have rested on for a long time through the centuries, and has developed into a pretty intense machine as it currently exists. We could possibly have a state that is shot through with these different recollectives, recollective forms, that is open to, in a sense, being a recollective state. And I think I get inspiration there from Gramsci, where he talked about kind of the integral state, which combines civil society and political society, political forms and civil forms. The only thing is he went to the party and saw it as the emergence of a party state. And I would see it as an emergence of a state that's committed to the ethics of recollectivity, to recollectivism. So that it would be open, that it would be one where it was constant public involvement in shaping the policies and so on. I mean, just beyond just participation. I think that looking back and seeing the incredible ethic and mind frame that we saw in the Paris Commune, as I mentioned, in 1871, that there was a real kind of almost short-lived way that they actually put together this kind of form of a weak collective state in a way. So we actually have that as a model, I think, on one level. And the question is, though, there's a bigger, wider world out there, and the forces that ended the commune, that were organized against it and destroyed it, are still out there. So the question then is, how do we start building these recollective forms that start changing the social terrain and the economic form, the political forms? We deal with the state. We don't ignore it. And that's where I think I don't believe in the notions of changing the world and without taking power and so on. I think that we have to confront the forms of power. It's not an either or. I'm partly in this book, one of the main missions is to avoid and get over the either ors that dominate a lot of our politics.
So you have said a number of times this hour, you've spoken about openness and how important openness is to the movement, the passage that you are advocating. And your interlocutor, your fictional interlocutor in this book, Mr. V, because this book is framed as a dialogue between you and this Mr. V, he has a lot of problems with that because openness implies a kind of indeterminacy. It suggests kind of an untethering from certain sort of bedrock principles that might unite people. So you might have all these different passages happening in society. But then if everyone's sort of open to revision and to reconceptualization and to a renewed kind of a different kind of strategizing than the current one, then it can get kind of, you know, chaotic and diffuse and confused and incoherent, that these various passages won't cohere in a way that will, in fact, lead to a recollectivized society. How do you respond to that?
Yes, and I would add that also the indeterminacy that's tied to an openness could be seen and is seen by the interlocutor as something that doesn't emphasize the bedrock of achieved results, right? No one wants part-time human rights. No one wants to reverse and see flux and so on, right? Because as we know, that's what something that we thought about in terms of capitalism is, you know, everything solid melts in the air and so on, right? These sort of things that have been thought of, you know, Marx that put it that way, and others have talked about this form. And basically the problem is that indeed we don't want to see that. So the one way of dealing with that in thinking about that, because that is the problem, if we leave things open and put them up for grabs, so to speak, we risk, right? We risk putting our achievements, whatever social justice we've achieved, up for grabs. And one response to that is that, one, the idea is not that the past is gone and everything's up for grabs. If people, in their rethinking of their collective, as they collectivize, recollectivize, they actually think of these past things as part of their resources in history. So they bring the things that they want to have in the new collective, the new form that they're reorganizing. And whether it's a broad version of reorganizing, even a small one, so women's rights and, you know, various other forms of sexual rights and things of that sort would be brought along into the other forms so that that history gets carried. It's less risky, in a sense, than one might think. Yes, there's risks. Then there's no way to avoid the risk. Unfortunately, anytime you open up a moment, any revolutionary moment, unfortunately, there is the risk that those who have very narrow, closed notions of power or society will take over. Again, Iran, thinking of that revolution, how many people were involved, let's say, from communist trajectory, other form, other radical allegiances were part of that revolution, and yet it ended up leading towards the current regime. And so this is always the problem. I mean, if any transformation, you open up the moment and you're also becoming a little vulnerable to it's settling and capturing, being captured by certain power forces. So the question is to think about what it means to open and who's in charge of the opening, and keeping in mind, wait a second here, we have to have a process for going forward. If we don't institutionalize the recollectivizing, we have to institutionalize that recollectivizing, then if we don't do that, we are vulnerable, yes, to some group consolidating and capturing the revolutionary moment or the transformative moment. And even the micro form, going back to our example of community banking, right? It's the same thing. If it doesn't could get captured by, you know, some form of corporate allegiances and so on. Say, hey, okay, keeping the money in the community, that's great. But you know what? Let's put them all into public-private partnerships, right? So we're always thinking about the notion of openness. We're thinking then about of how we actually we cannot limit it to public-private partnerships. And no one can say it's going to be this way and not that way. It's always us as a group, with the ever-ready possibility of reforming again, which is a principle that one hopes keeps participation for the involvement in the collective, in collectivizing, at the forefront of what's taking place, which is the sort of democratic element that's inherent in this idea of recollectivity.
Robert Latham joins us. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University. And we're talking about his book, The Politics of Evasion, A Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Robert, let me get back to this issue of the state, of the nation state, and how you feel about it. Because, you know, you say in some ways you want to move away from the state, but you've also told me that, you know, confronting the state is very important, and you could see a case in which a government, a state, being in passage or being open to recollective passage on the part of its residents, on the part of its people. And yet it just seems to me that given the kind of openness and flexibility and indeterminacy that you want and that would have to be part of this state, it just seems to me that, you know, it would be an incredibly rare thing for a state like this to emerge. It almost wouldn't be a state the way we think about nation states. So I just wonder whether you should just come out and say, if you believe it, that just states are inherently prone to fundamental injustice, and that to really think about a state that isn't that way is really kind of moving, is kind of a leap of faith, and it's a process of pushing our imaginations in directions that may never be achieved.
That's a fair question. I would answer it, and hopefully this is not evasion, but I would answer it by saying that it's the state as it's currently organized and conceived is one that is inherently hurtling, despite good intentions and so on, towards injustices in these various forms that have been part of its history, even though some groups benefit at different times that are not even the top elites historically, as we spoke about earlier in terms of certain workers and so on. So the question is, how does one reorganize it? I mean, I think we have seen some examples. I mean, I think Chavez's Venezuela was trying to move towards that, made these transformations. They changed some of their the original, I think, 2001, the land law opened up the possibility of collective ownership and communal decisions over land use, domicile, and so on. It was applied eventually, I think, even to the urban context not too long after that. Lots of other things were opened up, tons of communes, and there's works on this that are out there. People can find the research. And basically, we might even point even to a current example, a simple one, which is simple because the transformation is not as, let's say, radical as the Venezuelan case, Ecuador. So the current regime in Ecuador right now, I mean, made a very simple change not too long ago where they said that banks have to keep the money in Ecuador, or at least a certain large percentage, maybe as much as 60-70% at this point. And that opened up a huge amount of resources that could be invested in the public and public sphere activities, education, health, and housing, and so on. This was a good example of that exactly kind of recollectivizing that took place. They made an orthogonal kind of organizational change, altered the way the banks operate, and wow, it really led to something. Other things have taken place since then in the country. But there's an example now, where it's going and how far it's going to go with this transformation. Well, that's exactly the question of the passage, right? I mean, are they going to keep moving and rethinking and organizing how much of involvement of the collective will be in this, as opposed to right now they have a president that's pretty sophisticated and I think leading the charge in this endeavor, but that's not enough. So if he starts bringing in individuals the way we saw Chavez, you know, in a sense, organizing, facilitating, allowing, tolerating the bottom-up organization of all types of forms of collectives and communes in Venezuela, that could really be quite an interesting model if he's allowed to survive politically, because once, of course, it starts looking like it's interesting and working and wiping out poverty, dealing with inequality, well, this draws the attention of, you know, elite power structures, and of course, examples like that are not very welcome. So, however, that's, I think, the transformations that would be required. We have examples of that, again, even in these last decades. And the more of that, the more that we see leadership, and more importantly, we see cadres, individuals of society that are committed to this, I think the better chance there is of moving away from that older model that may be desirable because it's it has a history and, you know, it's tied with certain type of rights and commitments to the right norms of progressivism and so on. Yet it also only comes together with forms of injustices, has been copacetic with neoliberalism in deep ways, as we saw in the Clinton administration, for example. So I think that we do have that. So we do have this other model as a possibility. But people, I think, have to start thinking of the state differently and not think of the state as something that delivers, that gives you something. The state has to, in a sense, be truly captured all the way down, not just at the center, at the height of power, but has to be captured in this more decentralized way. And the society, the terrain, I would think, is the last point, most importantly, has to be changed. So that's where the recollectivities, as they try to change the social relations, change the actual terrain within which the state operates. That's most essential of all, I would think, to actually transform that so that the political parties respond differently to a different world that's beginning to emerge in various places, locales, and across the society.
Yeah, and as you write in your book, the very existence of a state can rest on a great deal of fundamental injustices, even if it veers in a progressive direction. Robert Latham is author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. He's also the author of The Liberal Moment, Modernity, Security, and the Making of Post-War International Order. But the focus today has been on the politics of evasion. Robert Latham is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto, Canada. Thanks so much, Robert, for joining me.
Welcome, and thank you very much for giving me the time and your great attention.
And that interview first aired on April 25th of this year. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.